हरे कृष्ण। सो वी कंटिन्यू आवर डिस्कशन द भागवतम फर्स्ट चैप्टर ऑफ द सिक्स्थ कैंटो। सो यस्टरडे वी डिस्कस्ड अबाउट हाउ परीक्षित आस्क्स द क्वेश्चन हाउ कैन पीपल बी सेव्ड फ्रॉम हेल एंड सुखदेव स्वामी गिव्स द आंसर द थ्री लेवल्स। फर्स्ट इज बाय अटोनमेंट, देन बाय विमर्शन बाय कल्टिवेशन ऑफ नॉलेज एंड देन केवलय भक्ति एंड देन ही कंक्लूड दैट प्योर डिवोशन इज द बेस्ट मेथड। And in that connection, he starts narrating a itihasam puratanam, an ancient history. And that was how Ajamil, so the story of Ajamil starts off not from his being a cultured person, but it starts off from the point where he has already deviated and fallen. And from there it moves on briefly, or rather quickly it moves on till the moment of his death, where he is very attached to his youngest son. And now, the time of death has come, and at that time he is thinking of his son named Narayan. So let's continue with text 28 onwards. Sapasha hastam strin drishtva guru shanati darunan vaktrutundvan urdhvaromna atmanam netumagatam दूरे क्रीडनकासक्तम् पुत्रं नारायणावयम् प्लावितेन स्वरेणोच्चैः आजुहावाकुलेन्द्रियः सो सपाश हस्तां सो विद् द पाश द यमपाश द नूज of the god of death in their hands, he saw three people, drishtva, purushan, atidarunan, they were very fearful looking, very scary, and two of their scary features are described here, vaktratunnan, urdhvaromna, vaktratunna means they had twisted mouths, and urdhvaromna, their hair were standing erect. So, normally, you know, when a person has a distorted facial features, now that can evoke either some sort of aversion or revulsion. No, this person doesn't look good. But or sometimes, if that distorted facial feature is indicative of a very harsh mentality, sometimes the person might just have accident have a distorted feature. But sometimes that indicates a very harsh or ugly, harsh or cruel or punishment-inducing mentality. Then that causes fear. Urdhvaromna. That means they were angry. Now that their hair standing on end, they were of an angry disposition. And they had come, he understood. Now, he was a Brahmana. So as a Brahmana, he knew about the Yamadutas. And he understood they had come for Atmanam Netumagatam. They had come to take his Atma to Yamaraj for being judged. And as he was sitting in his house, and suddenly he saw the Yamadutas coming. And he saw the Yamadutas coming. At that time, Dure, at a little distance, he saw Kridanaka Saktam. He saw that his son, he was playing. And naturally, because he was attached to his son, Putram Narayanahavyam. So he called out Ahavyam, he called him out to him, Plavitena Swarenochair. In loud sound, Plavitena. It was Narayana, four syllables, it's a long name. So he called it out. Ajuhava Kulendriya Ajuhava. He called it out loudly. Kulendriya is he was agitated. His senses were panicky, they were dried up. If we say Vyakul, so something similar, Akul. He was agitated, scared. And he called out. It's interesting. Why did he call out to his son? One thing is when we are attached to something, we naturally think of that thing at that time. And the acharyas explain later that actually, when he called out, he was calling out to his son. But when he uttered the name Narayan, at that time he remembered Lord Narayan. So he was not remembering Lord Narayan originally. But at this point, he just saw his son nearby. So that was the only thing that was, the only loving, only person whom he loved, who was close by, when he saw this fearsome sight, it was just a son. So it is not that he exactly expected his son to help him or rescue him from the Vishnu, from the Yamadutas. But it's just an instinctive reaction. Because of the attachment to the son and because of not having anyone nearby. But after he called out, that led to the remembrance of Narayana. Now, we'll discuss more about how exactly we became purified later on in the next chapter. But let's move on to the story here now. 30th verse. Nishamyam riyamanasya riyamanasya mukhato harikirtanam mukhato harikirtanam bhartur nama maharaja bhartur nama maharaja parshadah sahasapatan parshadah sahasapatan. So, Nishamya, on hearing riyamanasya, a person was about to die, at that mukhato harikirtanam, when they saw that he had chanted the names of Hari, at that time, Bhartur Nama Maharaja Bhartur. At that time, that Lord was the maintainer. So those who were maintained by him, his Parshadaha, they agatan. They immediately, sahasa. Sahasa means suddenly or immediately. Quickly they came there. Maharaja. So here Maharaja refers to Shukdev Goswami is addressing Parikshit Maharaj. So the utterance of the name of Narayan suddenly changed the dynamics of the situation. You know, it was that the name of Narayan was a complete game changer. What was happening was he was destined to go to the abode of Yama, but suddenly when he came, somebody else just popped up and sahasapatan. So the Yamdutas had come and they were about to take him, and at this particular point, the Vishnudutas suddenly appeared. Now, it's interesting that in the past ages, people had certain facility faculties by which they could see subtler entities also. Now, it's not mentioned specifically in the Bhagavatam whether Ajamil was given some special vision at that time by which he was able to see the Yamdutas as well as the Vishnudutas, or whether it was in the past ages everybody could see. But the important thing is that because he had done bhakti, he got this facility. So the Yamadutas came. So basically, what is the whole event that transpires over here? It is meant to help Ajamil understand two things. One is the gravity of the sins and the consequences that he was going to get for that, and the glory of the holy name by which he was rescued, glory of bhakti by which he was rescued. And for this whole lesson to be taught to him, at that time, he had to have a special vision, otherwise he would not have understood at all what is happening. So ultimately, as we discussed earlier yesterday, that the universe is a university. And whatever is the universe is a university. And whatever is required for learning lessons, that is provided in this world. So he was provided this vision by which he was able to see this. And he was able to see both the Yamdutas and the Vishnudutas. And he started, let's see what happened now after that. 31st. Vikarshato antarhrudayat, vikarshato antarhrudayat, dasipatim ajamilam, dasipatim ajamilam, yamapreshyan vishnuduta, yamapreshyan vishnuduta, varayama surojasa, varayama surojasa. Vikarshato antarhrudayat. So now, from within his heart, they were dragging ajamil. So here, the Bhagavatam uses the name Ajamil not just to refer to the body of the person, but to refer to the soul of the person also. So Ajamil was being dragged out. Mm-hmm. So it's not that at this particular point we know the Swarupa and he's going to be called by the Swarupa. No. So it's a person is a composite person, and whatever name they may have in a particular lifetime, that name may be used in the course after that lifetime also. So with Ajamil was dragged out, Dasipatim Ajamilam. He was referred to as Dasipati, as the husband of a prostitute. So normally, it is not common. It is the wife is often named by the often referred to by the name of the husband, but the husband is not usually referred to by the name of the wife. So occasionally, it may happen, but this was like a defining characteristic for him. It was a negative defining characteristic, and because that's a negative defining characteristic, that's why he's referred by that name. So we see in the 7th chapter of the first canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, Prabhupada titled that chapter as the son of Drona punished. Then he could have titled it as Ashwatthama punished. Why son of Drona? Because actually Drona was a very respectable person, and for his son to act in such a way and for a Brahmana to be punished, all this is very exceptional. So in certain contexts, people may be addressed in particular ways to emphasize the point which is being conveyed by the story over there. So So here Dasipati, we repeatedly will see Ajahn will be referred to as Dasipati to indicate that he had actually sunk to a very degraded condition. Yama Preshan, Vishnu Duta. So Yama Preshan, under the Vishnu Duta, under the servants of Yama, Vishnu Duta, what did they do? They stopped him. Varaya Masurojasa. Speaking loudly, forcefully, they stopped him. They cannot take him. They forbade him from taking him. So just at this point, there was no physical confrontation. Just stop. Don't take him. Just stop. They just called out. Yamdutas are surprised. Who is stopping us like this? Now the Yamdutas reaction will be described. 32. Uchu nishedita stamste. Vaivasvat purahasara.
Vaivasvat purahasara.
Keyuyam pratishedharo.
Keyuyam pratishedharo.
Dharmarajasya
shasanam. Dharmarajasya
shasanam. Uchu nishedita stamste. So uchu, uvacha is singular, uchu is plural. So now, quite often in the Bhagavatam, when there is a group of people and the group of people are serving a particular purpose, then at that time, when they are speaking, the Bhagavatam does not refer to them in the individual, in singular, it refers to them in the plural. So for example, in the Gopi Gita, it is, see, Gopya uchu. Now, Jiva Goswami, the Gopal Champu explains, that these verses are, each verse is said by a different gopi. And he analyzes the characteristics of the thought in that verse, he analyzes the characteristics of a gopi and he says, this verse is spoken by this gopi, this verse is spoken by this gopi. There's that analysis. But the point is, there the focus is on, not so much, at least in the flow of the Bhagavatam, when a collective is what is, when the collective action is being depicted. At that time, the Bhagavatam does not specify who is speaking. It focuses on, so there might be one Yamaduta who is speaking, or there might be two, one sometime, another second time, or they might have a leader who was speaking. But because that person was speaking not as an individual but as a representative of the group, so then it's referred to in the collective over here. So uchu nishedita stamste. So when they were forbidden at that time, vaivasvat purahasaraha. So it's interesting, vaivasvan is sun god. So vaivasvat is the son of vivasvan. So now, Vivasvan has many sons. We talk about one Vaivasvat, is Vaivasvat Manu in the, both in the Bhagavatam as well as the Bhagavad Gita. But according to the tradition, Yama and Yami, Yamuna Devi and Yama, they are considered to be the sons of Surya Devi. So Vaivasvat here refers to, they consider sons of Surya. So Yama is the son of Surya. And that's why here Yama is referred to as Vaivasvat. And Purahasaraha, his order carriers, his assistants. So then they are asking, Ke yuyam pratishedharo, who are you? Why are you stopping us? Dharmarajasya sasanam, that this is not just, we are not doing something arbitrarily, this is the order of Dharmaraj. And who are you who are stopping? So normally, now if, say there is a particular, say police come to arrest a particular person, and then at that time, somebody else also looks very authoritative. They come, stop, don't arrest him. Now, that thief's colleagues may say, don't arrest, always shoot him. That's a different thing. But if the other person also looks very authoritative, then they ask, who are you? Why are you stopping us? So now they will describe the future, the form. So they could also see that these are not just disruptors. They are very respectable looking person. They are authoritative looking person. And who are they? Now, normally, sometimes there is overlap of jurisdiction. You know, for example, if a crime is committed in Mumbai and then the criminal is in Pune, the Mumbai police can go to Pune to arrest them, but they are working in the Pune jurisdiction. So at that time they have to coordinate with the Pune police. Or sometimes there may be the police department and there may be anti-terrorist department and there may be various forces and they may have to coordinate and there may be overlapping jurisdictions. So now here's they are also respectable people. So who are these people? So they now, to some extent, try to infer, they try to guess. And in the next verse, they mention some of their inferences of who these people might be. So 33, Kasyava kuta ayataha,
Kasyava kuta ayataha,
Kasmad asya nishedhatha,
Kasmad asya nishedhatha,
Kim deva upadevaya,
Kim deva upadevaya,
Yam kim siddha sattamaha,
Yam kim siddha sattamaha.
Kasyava, again they ask you, who are you? Kuta ayata, from where have you come? So, this is their jurisdiction. So who are you? From where have you come? What is your, You are, how are you in our jurisdiction? That is the implied question. Kasmadasya nishedhatta. Why are you stopping us? Why are you preventing us from doing our duty? And then they are speculate. Are you some devatas? Are you some upadevatas? Or are you some siddhas? These are different being, different categories of evolved beings. And now, the next verse, they will, now, if you see, whatever guess they are making, the guess they are making, they are guessing that these are very exalted beings. They are not ordinary beings. And why they are thinking that they are exalted beings? Because they will describe their form is very extraordinary. And that form is described from 34 to 36. Sarve Padma Palashakshaha,
Sarve Padma Palashakshaha,
Pita Kausheya Vasasaha,
Pita Kausheya Vasasaha,
Kiritinaha Kundalino,
Kiritinaha Kundalino,
Lasat Pushkara Malinaha,
Lasat Pushkara Malinaha,
Sarve Chanutna Vayasaha,
Sarve Chanutna Vayasaha,
Sarve Charu Chaturbhujaha,
Sarve Charu Chaturbhujaha,
Dhanur Nisanga Sigada,
Dhanur Nisanga Sigada,
Shankha Chakrambuja Shriya, Disho Vitimira Lokaha,
Disho Vitimira Lokaha,
Urvanta Swana Svena Tejasa,
Urvanta Svena Tejasa,
Kim Artham Dharma Palasya,
Kim Artham Dharma Palasya,
Kim Karano Nishedhatha,
Kim Karano Nishedhatha.
So, the standard description of Vishnu applies to his dutas also. Sarve Padma Pala Shakshaha. They have lotus eyes, like blooming lotus petals. Pita Kausheya Vashasaha. That they are having yellow ornaments. Lord Vishnu here is Pitambar. So, similarly, Pita Kausheya Vashasaha. Their ornament, their dress is blue. Kiritinaha Kundalino. They have a crown on their head and they have a earrings. Now, Srila Prabhupada often, almost always, he translates kirita as helmet. Now, normally helmet is something which you use for fighting or driving or something like that. Normally if you are going to describe a beautiful person, you don't say he is wearing a helmet. Isn't it? So the point is, words also have different usages at different times. So nowadays, the word helmet is used primarily to refer to some defensive guy, defensive wear. Whether it be a batsman wearing while batting or a person while driving. But in the past, the word helmet basically used to refer to a headgear. And this is a headgear which serves both purposes. It is very beautiful, like a crown, but it is also a part of the armor. Now, it is meant to decorate the head as well as protect the head. So kiritinaha kundalino, yeah, the earrings, and then lasat pushkara malinaha, the shining garment they were wearing. And then Sarve Chanut Navayasaha, they were all very youthful. Sarve Charu Chaturbhujaha, and beautiful four arms. And then they had weapons. Dhanur Nisanga Digada, they had bows, arrows, mace. And Shankha Chakrambuja Shriyaha, beautifully Shankha and Chakra, these are the Vishnu's Ayudhas. And not only that, so this is the description of their person, but what is the effect? Dishi Vithimira Loka, Disho Vithimira Loka, they were removing the darkness in all directions, they were luminous. Kurvanta Svena Tejasa, by their own effulgence, they were actually lighting up everything. And so it was clear that they were celestial beings. They were something extraordinary. Kim Artham Dharmapalasya. Therefore, second time they are using the word Dharmapala. That we are actually carrying out the orders of Dharmaraj. And you also look like dharmic people. You also look like a people who are in the order of Dharma. So Kinkaran no nishedata. So those who are following the order of Dharmaraj, who's Kinkaras, why are you stopping him? That's what they ask over here. Now at this particular point, as this conversation is going on, Bhagavatam takes a step back, and then as the narrative is going to change, before the Vishnu does speak, the verse goes back to tell about the conversation, who is reciting the conversation. So Shri Shuka Vacha,
Shri Vacha,
Iti Ukte Yamadu Taiste,
Iti Ukte Yamadu Taiste,
Vasudevoktakarinaha,
Vasudevoktakarinaha,
Tantatyuchuhu Prahasyedam,
Tantatyuchuhu Prahasyedam,
Megha Nirradayagira,
Megha Nirradayagira.
So when in this way the Yamaduta spoke, at that time Vasudevoktakarinaha, so those who carry out the orders of Vasudev, they spoke back in return, Tantatyuchuhu Prahasyedam, so they were smiling.
So they were not disturbed. The Yamadutas were disturbed. Oh, why are they interfering? But the Vishnudutas, they are not disturbed. They are smiling. So they know what they are doing. They are convinced about what they are doing. They are confident about their power. So they are not disturbed. And they counter question. Megha nirhada yagira. So their poise, the very note of the questions which we see from the Yamadutas, they are disturbed. Who are you? What are, why are you interfering like this? But so they are disturbed. But Yamadutas are composed. They are smiling. And when they are speaking also, their voice is nirhadayagira. It is like the rumbling of clouds. That means it is calm, it is sonorous, it is authoritative. So they counter question. So it's interesting that the Vishnudutas don't directly identify themselves as the Vishnudutas. Repeatedly they've been asked, who are you? But where the Yamadutas are claiming their authority by saying that we are Dharmapalas the Kinkara, that we are the order carriers of Dharmapal. Here, the Yamadutas, the Vishnudutas challenge them. Are you really the order carriers of Dharmaraj? Then do you know Dharma? So you are saying that. So in that way, they counter their authority, they challenge their authority by asking a question. So Shri Vishnuduta Uchuhu,
Shri Vishnuduta Uchuhu,
Yuyam Vai Dharmarajasya,
Yuyam Vai Dharmarajasya,
Yadi Nirdesha Karinaha,
Yadi Nirdesha Karinaha,
Ruta Dharmasya Nastatvam,
Ruta Dharmasya Nastatvam,
Yaccha Dharmasya Lakshanam,
Yaccha Dharmasya Lakshanam.
So, Yadi Nirdesha Karinaha, if you really are the order carriers of Dharmarajasya, then tell us, what is Dharma? What is the Tattva of Dharma? And what is the Lakshana of a Dharma? Yaccha Dharmasya Lakshanam. So Prabhupada in this section, the purport explains that, you know, if we claim to be the order servants of someone, we should know our master. We should know his mood, his mission, what his vision is. Otherwise, we will be challenged and we will be embarrassed. So here we see, now from this appearance, the Yamadutas look like very ghastly, gory beings. But when we start speaking, when they will start speaking soon, we will see that they are also learned beings. And they are also for doing things with an understanding, with a fairly good level of understanding. But here, the Yamadutas are counter-challenging and asking them, what is Dharma? What is a Dharma? And then they elaborate the question. And the reply of the Yamadutas will be on the response to the elaborated question. 39. Katham svidhriyate dandaha. Kimvasya sthanam ipsitam,
Kimvasya sthanam ipsitam,
Dandyah kim karina sarve,
Dandyah kim karina sarve,
Aho svitkati chinrunam,
Aho svitkati chinrunam.
So, katham svidriyate danda, how is punishment administered? So, they are saying that, the Yamadutas are saying that, we are following the order of Dharma, and we are basically administering punishment. That was their intent. So the Yamadutas are countered, questioned about his intent. Tell, okay, if you are saying they are going to punish him, then how is punishment administered? What is the kimvasisthanam ipsitam? And what is the method in which, what is the reason for which this is administered? And further, dandya kim karina sarve. So okay, punishment is to given. Is it given to everyone? Or aho svitkati chindruna? So is it administered to some people? So basically, they ask them about the knowledge of Dharma and the specific purpose, specific service that they are doing within the jurisdiction of Dharmaraj, that is administering punishment. So how is this all this done? They ask, so Yamaduta Uchuhu,
Yamaduta Uchuhu,
Veda Pranihito Dharmo,
Veda Pranihito Dharmo,
Yadharmastad Viparyayaha,
Yadharmastad Viparyayaha,
Vedo Narayana Sakshat,
Vedo Narayana Sakshat,
Swayam Bhurti Shushruma,
Swayam Bhurti Shushruma,
so iti Shushruma. So they, to say that we have heard, that they are also quoting authority, what have we heard? Veda Pranihito Dharma. Dharma is known through the Vedas. And whatever is contradictory to the what is given the Vedas, ya adharma tad viparyaya. That is opposed to that is adharma. And why are the Vedas the source of Dharma? Say, Veda Narayana Saksha. They are Narayan himself. We say, but Narayan is a person and Veda is a book. So how is Veda Narayan? Swayambhu. They are born from him. they are manifested from him. So it is described in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad that the opening that the Vedas come from the breath of Vishnu. So Swayambhu, in that sense they are self-manifested. And Iti Shushruma, this is what we have heard. Now, there are, when we talk about the Vedas, Veda Pranihito Dharma. So, what exactly is Dharma? Is Dharma a set of law codes? You know that, okay, this is a law and this is a punishment for this violating this law and is a reward for doing this right. And is it, if it is like that, at one level, it is like that. But if it is like that, then is it like a long, long list of all possible activities that anybody might do? They are all already anticipated and their punishments are already given. And then is it like, you know, we are expected to have an encyclopedic brain where we remember all the dharmic codes everywhere. And whatever there is, like a big, big library which everybody is supposed to remember. And then based on that, they have to choose, okay, this situation I have to do this, this situation I have to do this, this situation I have to do this. No, it's not exactly like that. Dharma, when we say, see, there is a law and there is a principle. So, dharma is more a matter of principles than of laws. There is an aspect of law also to it. But, even when we consider laws, even in normal jurisdiction also, normal courts also, now, laws don't apply in a literal one-to-one correspondence in all situations. Yes, if somebody is a murderer, maybe the punishment is that person should be given life imprisonment or that person should be hanged. Yes, but then if that person is murdered in self-defense, then there's a whole different dynamic involved over there. So, the person may not be culpable at all. So, that means in real life, whenever any law is translated, so real life has many subtle nuances to it. And that's why no law applies directly. In the system of karma were purely mechanical and there were simply law codes which were imposed, then there would in one sense no need for Yamaraj at all. If everything is mechanical, okay, this law, this punishment, this law, this punishment, then why do we need any person to administer justice also? So the point is that dharma is not so much laws, it is principles. There are certain ways in which we are meant to act and certain ways which are not meant to act. There is karma, there is akarma and there is vikarma. So, vikarma brings bad reactions. Karma brings good reactions. Karma leads to progress towards liberation. So, when we say that Vedas give us dharma, the Vedas give us principles. And we understand those principles and then we apply those principles according to our time, place, circumstance. That's why even in the Bhagavatam there is, in the Bhagavata also there is the Veda Vadrataha. Those who stick to the letter of the Vedas without understanding their ultimate purpose. These are called as literalists. Literalists means they take everything just literally. But factually speaking, nobody can take everything literally. You know, if we say that Anisha Sarva Bhutanam Tasyam Jagrati Sanyami. Asyam Jagrati Bhutani Sanisha Pashyato Mune. So now if I take this verse literally, that is night for all living beings, is day for the self-realized, and that is just night for the self-realized is day for all living beings. What does it mean? You know, maybe if you want to take it literally, you can say America and India are 12 hours apart. You know? So, what then it is night in America, it is day in India. So, all self-controlled people are in India, all self-gratified in America. So, when it is night in America, it is day in India. No, but if you look at the context, the Bhagavata is not talking about geographical time zones over there. The Bhagavata is talking about psychology. So there are so many places where you just can't take things literally. And that's why there are people who are dharmagya, who are required. And of course, Acharya is a dharmagya, but in one sense, all of us also have to understand the principles of dharma and then internalize them and apply them according to our time, place, circumstance. Srila Prabhupada also writes in the introduction of Nectar of Instruction that once one comes to the mode of goodness, then how to advance further is revealed from within. That means one sattvat sanjayate jnana. So, Veda Pranihito Dharma. Vedas give the principles of dharma. And those who violate those principles, or whatever actions comprise the violation of those principles, they are adharma. Adharma is that viparyaya, the opposite of that. And this way, so this Vedic knowledge that is there, that is actually not just knowledge, it is God manifesting as knowledge. Veda Narayana Sakshat. It is God Himself. Jnanam Yeyam Jnanagamyam Hridi Sarvasya Vishtitam. In 13th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that He is knowledge, He is the object of knowledge, and He is the goal of knowledge. So Vedas give us this ultimate knowledge of how to live by which we can achieve the ultimate destination. That's why Vedo Narayana Sakshat. Vedas are Narayana Himself. And this is what we have heard. Swayambhur Iti Shushruma. 41st. Yena Swadhamyami Bhava.
Yena Swadhamyami Bhava.
Rajah Sattvatamo Mayaha.
Rajah Sattvatamo Mayaha.
Gunanamakriya Rupair.
Gunanamakriya Rupair.
Vibhavyante Yathatatam.
Vibhavyante Yathatatam.
So they said, it is from Narayan, the Vedas have come. And then now that of Yena, by that Lord Narayan, Swadhamyami Bhava. He stays in his own abode, but from there he manifests this material world. Rajasattva Tamomaya, which is made of the three modes of material nature. And from these three modes, Guna Nama Kriya Rupa. So Nama Kriya Rupa. So Kriya is like Leela. We are also seeing in the Guru Ashtakam. So Nama Rupa Gundila. So like that here. From the three modes, the names, the activities, the forms, all these are the living entities manifest. Vibhavyante yathartham, accordingly. So here, now they are answering the question, how punishment is administered. And in that connection, they are giving some background. So the modes will be used for two purposes over here, by the Amutas. First is to explain how the modes influence human behavior and then they cause consequences. And the other is, the modes are used also to infer about the nature of dharma and adharma. So here they start by going, so what the point I earlier made was that the Vishnu, the Yamadutas are also not just like brawn without brain. It is not that they are just ugly looking powerful beings. They are also intelligent people. They also know the principles of dharma. And they are telling the principles of dharma over here. So here they are answering how. So first they say that, okay, so that Lord Narayan has manifested this whole world, which according to three modes gives people their various names, forms and activities. And in the activities that they people do in this world, they are witnessed. And who are those witnesses? That is mentioned in the next verse. Suryognikam marudevaha.
Suryognikam marudevaha.
Soma sandhyahani dishaha.
Soma sandhyahani dishaha.
Kamku swayam dharmaiti.
Kamku swayam dharmaiti.
Ya ete dahyasya sakshinaha.
Dahyasya sakshinaha.
Dahya. Dahya is 10. These are the 10 witnesses. Suryo agni kam marudeva. Straightforward. So there is sun, fire, sky, wind, devaha. Deva refers variously to the devatas, the collective. See, there are prominent devatas and there are upadevatas. So sometimes in the Ramayana Mahabharata, there are the dikpalas that are used. Dikpalas are four direction protectors. They are prominent devatas. Soma sandhyahani dishaha. The moon is there, the day is there, night is there. And then the directions. Kampu swayam dharmaiti. Kampu is, further is water and land. And swayam dharma. Dharma can refer to Yamaraj. Prabhupada explains, can refer to super soul also. So, ya ete dahiyasa sakshina. Now here the principle is that if you look at these 10, now that the point of this is that we cannot get away by doing things secretly. We may think that I have removed all trace. Okay, I did something, but I removed all trace of it. No. And sometimes if we surf on the internet, there is a incognito mode. So in incognito mode, when we browse, at that time, there is no record left of the history of wherever we are browsed. But, you know, even when we are incognito, we are not invisible. That means, if we are visiting a particular site, on our computer, there may be no record left of which sites a person has gone to. But, whichever site they have visited, they have a track of which IP had come there. And then the network also, which also keeps track. So in fact, in many ways, the internet is quite rigorously policed. Whatever happens, policed not in the sense that there is control, there may be control also, but there is monitoring. And you know, practically, now if people use internet and search on Google, you know, every single Google search that is done, Google has a record of that. And you know, if they are asked for their information and they give their information, then you know, even 20, 30, 40 years, of course, the internet was not there at that time. But the point is that everything is recorded over there. So the traces of that may not be there on our computer. But elsewhere, the information is properly there. So like that, you know, when people may do something wrong and they may say that nobody has seen me. But they may remove the traces of that action from their end. But there is a whole network which monitors. And in that network, whatever it is they are doing is not lost. It is recorded. And that's why the point is that the question was, how is justice to be administered? How is justice administered? So now for administering justice, if somebody has done wrong, you have to have witnesses of the wrongdoing. And so they said that in this system of cosmic administration, there are all these witnesses. And they, through them, justice, through them, they are the medium through which the administration of justice takes place. So 43, etaira dharmo vikyatah,
etaira dharmo vikyatah,
sthanam dandasya yujyate,
sthanam dandasya yujyate,
sarve karmanurodhena,
sarve karmanurodhena,
dandam arhanti karinah,
dandam arhanti karinah.
Etair adharmo vijnata. By all these, adharma is seen. What have you done? Sthanam dandam yute. So in the question there was kim sthanam. Now what is the mechanism by which punishment is administered? What is the reason for it? This is a system. They are the witnesses. Dandasya yujyate. Danda is given. So the cause of adharma is administered. This is the punishment. What is the punishment for? Okay, this particular act was done. Sarve karmanurodhena. And then according to the act that a person has performed, according to each particular act, dandam arhanti karinaha. So karina is the doer of the karma. So whatever karma a person has done, they will get the consequence of that accordingly, because there are these witnesses who will observe and who will punish. So now at one level, this knowledge that Krishna witnesses everything, it can be very sobering. Now that means we understand that we all have a dark side. Where we struggle against anarthas, sometimes succumb to our anarthas, sometimes we have very unnasty thoughts, sometimes we may even do some wrong things. When we think that Krishna is aware of this, this can actually embarrass us, this can make us feel very very insecure that Krishna knows everything. But another level, we also understand that Krishna is not there, Krishna's purpose is not to catch us when we go wrong. His purpose is to catch us when we fall. Krishna's purpose is not to catch us when we go, "Hey, you did that wrong, I'll punish you now." Krishna is not a fault-loving God or a fault-finding God who is just waiting to punish us for wrongs. Krishna's purpose is not to catch us when we do wrong, but it is to catch us when we fall. So Krishna was like a parent. He wants the child to rise. When the child is rising, sometimes the child may fall. So Krishna catches and helps the child rise again. So the system of justice is there, but higher than justice is mercy. And Krishna is not just a just God. Krishna is a merciful God. And ultimately, the system of justice is subordinated to the system of mercy. And when you practice, and this whole pastime is ultimately a pastime of extraordinary mercy being mercy. Being exhibited by the Lord. So of course, you know, mercy is something which is meant to fulfill the purpose of justice. Justice is not just the sake of punishing people. Justice is ultimately for the purpose of reforming people. So the government does not get any joy in keeping people in jail. But if the people are going to break the law, then they have to be put in jail. But if the people are ready to reform themselves, then they can very well be released from the jail. So like that, justice is meant to prevent the lawbreakers from breaking the law. But mercy is not just about releasing the lawbreakers and letting them free. Mercy is meant to transform the lawbreakers into law abiders and then free them from the consequences. So when we talk about mercy, at one level mercy is causeless. We'll discuss this thing much more when we come later. That mercy is causeless, but mercy, we can beseech mercy. See, if the government wants, they can release any prisoner from the jail. But if some prisoners are law abiding, then the likelihood of them being released from jail is much more. So similarly, if we are following the principles of dharma, then Krishna's purpose is not to punish us. Krishna's purpose is to purify us, to elevate us. So then the karma, the principles of karma may not act that much on devotees if their purpose is fixed in the service of Krishna. So on one side, knowing that Krishna witnesses everything, that can scare us. But on the other side, we can also feel secure. And even when I'm struggling and I'm battling against the anarthas and I feel that I cannot fight them, at that time also Krishna is watching and Krishna will help. So it's like if a person is a thief and then that person sees a police, then they'll get scared. But if a person is a victim of a thief and that time they see the police, they'll feel reassured, oh, now help is coming. So, you know, sometimes our anarthas, lust, anger, greed, they make us like a thief and they make us do wrong things. But if we are fighting those anarthas, then even if we are being pushed and impelled by the anarthas, at that time we are not the thief. We are actually being victimized by the thief. And then when we are aware that Krishna is present, then rather than feeling insecure, we feel secure. Although I have these nasty desires, although I sometimes push towards bad things, but still Krishna is not up there punishing me. Krishna is here to help me. So it's like what we need to do is have a proper understanding of Krishna. The whole system of karma, the whole system of justice is meant to help us rise. It is not meant to simply punish us. So now, they go on over here. Sambhavanti hi bhadrani.
Sambhavanti hi bhadrani.
Viparitani chanagaha. Viparitani chanagaha. Karinam guna sangosti.
Karinam guna sangosti.
Dehavanaya karma kret.
Dehavanaya karma kret.
So now, first it said that according to three modes, everything is created. All living beings, they have their form, activities and names. And then whatever they are doing, that is witnessed by the witnesses, these 10 witnesses. Now it is said, Sambhavanti, after being thus created, these people, they Bhadrani and Viparitani, they do auspicious activities, pious activities and impious activities. Chanagaha, so the Yamadutas, they are also knowing that these are, whoever these people are, they are anagaha, they are sinless, they are pure. Karinam guna sangosi. Now why do they act Bhadrani or Viparitani? Why do they act sometimes auspiciously or inauspiciously? That is because guna sangosti. Because of the association with the mode, dehavan naya karmakrit. Na ya akarmakrit. The soul cannot stay inactive. We all have to be active. And because we have to be active, we act under the influence of the modes, we may act rightly or wrongly. And in that way, now they are explaining that there are the witnesses for our actions, and now they are going to explain how the actions take place. 45. Yena yavan yatha dharmo.
Yena yavan yatha dharmo.
Dharmo veha samihitaha.
Dharmo veha samihitaha.
Sa eva tat phalam bhunte.
Sa eva tat phalam bhunte.
Tatha tavadamutravai.
Tatha tavadamutravai.
So, yena yavan, each person as they perform adharma, adharma, dharmo veha, this or that, iha, samihita, as they perform accordingly, sa eva tat phalam bhunte, they get the reactions, they enjoy the fruits, bhunte can mean enjoy, bhunte can mean suffer, it's undergo basically, bhunte, tatha tavad amutravai, so tatha tavad, it started yena yavan, tatha tavad, so amutravai, in the next life, amutra refers to next life. So, people do actions and they get the consequences for their actions. This is the system of justice. And then further they say, Yatheha deva pravara, Yatheha deva pravaras,
Yatheha deva pravaras,
Traividhyam upalabhyate,
Traividhyam upalabhyate,
Bhuteshu guna vaichitrya,
Bhuteshu guna vaichitrya,
Tatha Tathanyatra numiyate.
Tathanyatra numiyate.
So, deva prabara. So, they are addressing the Vishnudas quite respectfully. Earlier they said that you are anagha. Now, deva prabara. You are the best among the devas. So, traividhyam upalabhyate. Upalabhyate means we observe. In this world, we see different kinds of people. People of three kinds. Broadly, people influenced by the three modes. Bhuteshu vaichitrya. Under the influence of the modes, people are different kinds. And tatha anyatra anumiyate, anumiyate, we can infer. And sometimes we consider anuman as very bad. Don't speculate, Prabhupada would say. There is speculation and there is inference. inferring is essential. Now, because we live, we are finite beings and we have finite knowledge. So many times we have to infer things. So anumiyate, so anuman may not be good, but anuman praman. Praman means it's a valid way of acquiring knowledge. So shabda praman is the primary force of way of acquiring knowledge. But anuman praman and pratyaksha praman are not wrong. They can be wrong when they show us things which contradict shabda praman, or when we use them to justify rejection of shabda praman. But as subordinate sources of knowledge, they're perfectly fine. When Prabhupada also in his song, Markine Bhagavad Dharma, said, "Ache kiche karjatabe ei anumane, nahe ke no ani bena ei yugrasthane." Ei anumane, I guess, I infer that there must be some purpose for which you have brought me here, O Lord. Otherwise, why would you bring me to such a terrible place? So we all have to infer in our life practically. So they are saying over here, so just as we see different kinds of people are influenced by different modes, similarly, anyatra, in the next world, in the next life, in the previous life, both also the same diversity will be there. So this is, now, what is the, why are they talking about all this? That they will explain the next verse. Why are they talking about the three modes over here and the variety because of three modes? That we will see as we move forwards. Vartamano anyayo kalo,
vartamano anyayo kalo,
gunabhikyapako yatha,
gunabhikyapako yatha,
evam janmanyayo retad,
evam janmanyayo retad,
dharma dharma nidarshanam,
dharma dharma nidarshanam.
So vartamano anyayo loka, in this world, in the next world, we see guna under the influence of the mode, guna abhigyan yatha, as we see that under the influence of the mode, there are different people with different qualities. So evam janmanyayo retad. And similarly, we see that in the next life also it will be there. So, dharma adharma nidarshanam. So, just as we can infer the three modes and their variety in this life, and we observe it in this life and we infer that it will be there in the previous and next life. Similarly, we can infer that there are people who have dharma, who have adharma, or who act dharmically, who act adharmically. So, when we see people acting dharmically, we understand that they will get the results of that in a future life. And when we see people acting adharmically, we see that they will get the results in a future life. Or if we see people suffering here, that means that is a result of something which they have done in the past coming. So just as there is a transition, there is a continuation of the modes that people have, whatever modes we acquired in the previous life, they carry over in this life. Similarly, whatever activity, whatever tendency towards dharma or adharma we have, that is also carried over. And accordingly, we get reactions. 48. Manasaiva pure devaha. Purva rupam vipashyati. Anumimamsate apurvam. Manasa bhagavanajaha. So, here Bhagavan refers to the Yamaraj. Bhagavanajaha. Aja unborn, so just as Aja Brahma is omniscient, similarly Yamaraj is also omniscient and Manasa, and he is able to observe by his mind. He doesn't need physical eyes to see all this. Manasaiva pure deva, so what people have done in the past, what they are doing now, and what the consequences are appropriate for them in future. All this can be inferred based on observing the observation which the competent authority Yamaraj can do. And in this way, Yamaraj knows what is to be done. So previously, it was asked how is the system of justice administered. So they describe that the system of justice is administered by Yamaraj. So there are devatas, there are the witnesses, there are the modes which impel people towards action. And what actions they have done, what reactions they will get, that is perceived by Yamaraj, and accordingly he gives reactions. So we'll move to 2-3 verses more, then we'll have question answers. So here the analysis will go on, and then they will come back to the specific case of Ajamil. So when they start coming to the case of Ajamil, we'll stop and we'll have question answers at that time. Etair adharmo vijñātah. Yathāgyastamasā yukta. upasate vyaktamevahi.
Upasate vyaktamevahi.
Naveda purvam aparam.
Naveda purvam aparam.
Nashta janma smutistatha.
Nashta janma smutistatha.
It is stated that just as there are some places where Prabhupada gives one translation and Chakravarti Pada gives another translation, Sridhar Swami gives slightly different translation. The essential meaning remains the same. So, here Prabhupada says that just as a sleeping person, tamasa, he uses, Prabhupada uses the word sleeping person. It's a sleeping person forgets about everything. Person just lost in sleep. Like that, Prabhupada is saying, people get absorbed in bodily consciousness. And when they're absorbed in bodily consciousness, they don't know anything about their previous life, they don't know anything about their future life. They're just lost in the temporary world that they're in. Just lost in their temporary world. And similarly, so Chakravarti Pada explains that there are animals. So tamasa yukta, he says, that refers to animals. This is animals don't have any awareness of anything higher. Animals simply exist. They're simply driven by their body for the purpose of eating, sleeping, mating, defending. And they are not aware of any, where I have come from, where I am into. They are not aware of any metaphysics. So similarly, people in body consciousness, they are not aware of all this. So the point that is being made is, people who are performers of dharma or adharma, they may not be aware of all the cosmic system of observation and justice that is there. That is because they are ignorant. They are absorbed in ignorance and they are like a sleeping person or like an animal. Text 15. Panchabhi kurute swarthan.
Panchabhi kurute swarthan.
Panchavedatha panchabhi.
Panchavedatha panchabhi.
Ekastu shodashena trin.
Ekastu shodashena trin.
Swayam saptad saptadasho ashnute.
Swayam saptadasho ashnute.
So here the material nature is analyzed into various elements and described. There are the five senses, the five working senses. Panchabhi kurute swarthan. So swartha means one's own purpose. Whatever is purpose, with the panchabhi, the five working senses, a person does activities. And similarly, pancha vedatha panchabhi. And what is vedatha? That which is to be known. So there are five sense objects which we try to know with the sense of with the senses. So ekast chodashena. So there are, we work with the five senses. There are things which we want to know, and then after knowing, we want to take them in with our senses to enjoy them. And then ekast chodashena. There is a shodasha, that the 16th is the mind which is above them. And swayam saptadasho ashnute. The saptadasho is the 17th, that is the atma itself. So, you know, we see that Sankhya has different ways of analyzing. And sometimes it may be analyzed into 24 elements, sometimes it may be into, as it is here, 16 elements. So, this basically the point is not the specific number which is analyzed into. The point is to understand matter and spirit and their diversity. So, matter can be analyzed in different ways. So, just like we have Ayurveda and Allopathy, they both analyze the body and they analyze the body in different ways. The purpose is to treat the body. So, Sankhya itself, we have this broadness of vision where material nature can be analyzed in different ways. And 11th canto of Uddhava Gita and a purport, Chakravarti Pada says that actually the great sages exhibit their creativity by analyzing material nature in different ways, and this creativity pleases me. So, you know, we have a particular vision of the cosmos described in the Bhagavatam, and modern science may reveal a different vision of the cosmos. These are just different ways of analyzing the universe, and we have to focus on what is the purpose of all this, and we don't have to get caught in the specifics. So here the point is, this is the 16 elements are there, and above this the 17th element is the Atma, which ashnute, which enjoys, which suffers, which undergoes basically the reactions. Tad etat shodashkalam. Lingam shaktitrayam mahat.
Lingam shaktitrayam mahat.
Datte anusamsmritim pumsi.
Datte anusamsmritim pumsi.
Harsha shoka bhayatidam.
Harsha shoka bhayatidam.
Student? Yeah. Go for 3 or 4 more verses. So, shodashakalam. So, with these 16 elements, the body which he has got, lingam shakti trayam mat. In this body, a person is impelled to act in particular ways by the modes. So, the body and the modes are interrelated. And the body is like a machine. Now, if I have a car, I cannot make it move like a airplane. If I have got a boat, I cannot make it move like a car. So each machine has a particular way of functioning. So the body is like a machine. And it has a particular way of functioning. Now, even if I say I have got a boat and I haven't got a car. So I cannot take a boat on land. But even when I am taking a boat in the water, there also I have to regulate it. Isn't it? I cannot say I'll take my boat and crash it into some other boat. And I'll destroy my boat or destroy their boat, I'll sink the other person. So the boat has a particular set of limitations. But within that limitation does not justify responsibility. That limitation means, okay, I cannot do certain things, but within that also I have to have some regulation. So like that, there are four varnas, Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra. And people who have particular natures will act according to their nature. But when we say that, okay, I have this kind of, this is my nature. But within that nature also regulation is required. Some people may be more gregarious. They want to be with people, talk with people, meet with people. But while meeting with people also there has to be regulation. No, we should not associate too much with materialists, with non-devotees, with opposite sex. We may want to meet people and that is fine. Some people may want to like to be more alone. They may introvert, that's also fine. But if somebody in the name of being alone says that, no, I'll never associate with devotees. That is also not proper. So we cannot just reject our nature. But that does not mean we have to completely surrender entirely to our nature and not have any regulation. So within the limitation imposed by our nature, there are choices. And we have to choose responsibly. So the modes, basically we could say that the modes shape the kind of machine that we get. And based on the machine, we function. But still, with the machine that we have to choose responsibly. And anusamsrutim pumsa, that the soul undergoes material existence in this world because it is impelled by the three modes. Impelled by the three modes, the soul acts responsibly. Harshi shoka bhaya artitam. There is sometimes joy, there is sometimes grief, there is sometimes fear, and overall there is distress. And this is the soul basically undergoes material existence. Dehya agnya jit shad vargo, dehya agnya jit shad vargo, nechan karmani karyate, nechan karmani karyate, koshakari vatmanam, koshakari vatmanam, karmanachhadya muhiyati. So, achhadya, one gets covered, muhiyati, one gets bewildered. So, dehe agnya ajit shadvargo, when this embodied soul is ignorant, and shadvargo, so with this, driven by the mind and senses, nechen karmani karyate. Even if the soul doesn't desire to act in a particular way, the soul is impelled to act. That is by the anarthas. Koshaka ivatmana. And then the example that is given over here, just as a silkworm acts and gets bound. Similarly, the soul acts and gets bound. The silkworm gets stuff out of its own mouth, but then it gets that what it gets out of its own mouth, that becomes its tomb, which it gets trapped. So like that, we become bound by our own karma. And we need to be careful about what kind of karma that we do. So, nahi kaschit kshanam api,
nahi kaschit kshanam api,
yatu tishthatya karma kru,
yatu tishthatya karma kru,
karyate yavashah karma,
karyate yavashah karma,
gunai swabhavikair balat,
gunai swabhavikair balat.
So this is almost similar to the 3.5 in the Bhagavad Gita. Karyate vyashapakarma sarva prakriti jai gunai. That is the only difference there. So the theme is similar, that the soul cannot stay inactive. Some yogis or some spiritualists say, nothing doing. No, let me not do anything. Let me become inactive. But the bhakta says, nothing doing to nothing doing. Nothing doing, that is not possible only. So, we cannot avoid doing anything. So, nothing doing means I will not get involved in the idea of becoming inactive. So, the modes are going to impel us and we have to act. So, the way we act, that is what we have to choose. The problem is not action. The problem is misdirected action. So, the yogi, those who try to adopt the path of inaction, they misdiagnose the cause of the problem. The cause of bondage is not action per se. It is improper action. So, when they misdiagnose, then they give a wrong prescription. Their prescription is, action is the cause of bondage, so inaction will be the way to liberation. But when you understand misdirected action is the cause of bondage, then properly directed action becomes the cause of liberation. So at this stage, the Yamadutas, if you see their whole analysis of the philosophy, they are not talking about Narayan directly. They are not talking about bhakti to Narayan. They are talking about Narayan as the source of the Vedas. Narayana is manifesting in the Vedas, Narayana is manifesting the whole world, but they are not specifically talking about bhakti over here. So we'll see later on that they are not aware of the glory of bhakti. And that will be revealed in the third chapter when they go to the Yamaramraj and they speak over there. But here they are talking about how the living entity is impelled to act. Labdhva nimittam avyaktam.
Labdhva nimittam avyaktam.
Vyakta vyaktam bhavatyauta.
Vyakta vyaktam bhavatyauta.
Yatha yon yatha bijam.
Yatha yon yatha bijam.
Swabhavena baliyasa.
Swabhavena baliyasa.
So swabhavena, according to one's swabhava one acts. Baliyasa, it's a very powerful swabhava that we get. Labdhva nimittam avyaktam. Labdhva means we obtain this. So we acquire. So it is said that the body is like a machine that is impelled to act. It cannot be inactive. Now how do we get this machine? Vyakta vyakta bhavatyota. So what we have done in the past, accordingly we get this body. And the bodily characteristics that we have, yatha yoni yatha bijam. So yoni, Chakravarti Pada explained, refers to the mother. Bija refers to the father. So when a child is born, child has some characteristics of the mother, some characteristics of the father. So some people argue that the progeny has the characteristics of the parents, and therefore the parents are the determiners of the progeny. So there is no role for the soul over here, for any soul to come into the body, because the characteristics of the offspring are determined from the parents, and we do see that. So here we have to understand that karma works in subtle ways. So firstly, that by the system of karma it is arranged that a soul who is meant to have a particular kind of body, that soul is born into a particular family, into a way that is born to a particular mother and father. So if a soul is meant to be very intelligent, by the past karma the soul has done some good karma, and in this body the soul is meant to be intelligent. So then it may well be that the soul is born in a family where the parents are also very educated, they are intelligent, and then the soul gets those genes accordingly, and if we talk about the long language of modern biology. But there is also, so the line of genetics and the line of karma, they can be made to coincide by the arrangement of the Lord. So because at a broad level we see that the soul gets a particular kind of body, and when it's going to get a particular body, it has to come through some mechanism, and that mechanism also has its shaping influence. Yesterday I mentioned how the human beings, especially human infants, they are very dependent on their parents, and they require a lot of care. And for that care, the parents have to feel attachment to the child. And only when the parents they see some similarity. Oh, this child has my eyes, this child has my nose, this child has the eye like this. They feel a natural attachment over there, and then they take care of the children because of that. So the lines of karma and the lines of genetics, they coincide. Lines of heredity, we could say, not genetics specifically, heredity, they coincide by the higher system, the karmana daivanetrena, daivanetra. Another point is, so genetics or heredity can explain some things, but heredity can't explain everything. So there are famous examples throughout history. Say for example, one of the most famous musicians in the Western world of Mozart. And now if you look at Mozart, nobody in his family had anything to do with music. Neither his parents, neither his grandparents, neither his aunts, neither his great grand aunts or whatever. And still he was not just good at music, he was a genius at music. So in some cases, if we were completely determined by our genes, then such cases become inexplicable. So we are not so certain features of our body and mind are determined by our genes, but certain we carry from our past life. And that's how the line of karma, they include the line of genes, line of heredity, but they supersede that, they exceed beyond that. So yatha yon yatha bijam. So we get certain characters from the mother, certain characters from the father. Esha prakriti sangena purushasya viparyayah asit sa eva nachira Isha Sangad Viliyate. So here the Yamdutas demonstrate the knowledge of the Supreme Lord also. They say the cause of bondage is Prakriti Sangena, and the cause of liberation is Isha Sangha. So by associating with material nature, Purushasya viparya, the soul acts in contrary ways, self-destructive ways, and the soul gets bound. But nachira, quickly, without much delay, that soul can become isha sangat viliyate. Viliyate means all this material bondage disappears. The soul can become liberated. So, at this point, the answer of the Amrutas concludes. And then from here onwards, they will talk about a specific case of Ajamili. And they will say how this principle applies to Ajamil, how according to the system of justice, Ajamil is, it is justified to punish him. And that's why they are carrying him. So any questions till now? Yes.
You mentioned that Krishna was asking about justice. So there are other statements also like that Krishna doesn't interfere in his own system. Also we hear that
So, you said Krishna's mercy is greater than justice. But then we have also heard that Krishna's mercy, Krishna does not interfere with the material world, the system he has created, or Krishna's mercy comes only through his devotees. So, how exactly does all this work? Yeah. See, the first point is that there is a normal regularity of events in material nature. So, and that pattern is what is standard for you. So, does God interfere with it? Yes, He does interfere. In fact, there are miracles. You know, when Krishna lifted Govardhan Hill, everybody was amazed. Now, the very fact that they were amazed indicates that normally lifting of a hill was not easy. It is not happening. So, there was the very astonishment of the Vrajvasins indicates that there was a normal pattern. And that normal pattern was violated over there. So, there is a normal pattern which is also understood, and there is a Krishna can suspend that is also understood. So we see this with respect to the, say, the law of gravity over there in that particular thing. So like that applies to the law of karma also. The specifically how Krishna intervenes, that is something which we cannot predict. So broadly speaking, what we understand is Krishna's mercy primarily comes through the opportunity to practice bhakti. Guru Krishna prasade paaye bhakti lata beej. So now when we are practicing bhakti, it is not necessary that all the miseries that are going to come to us while being in the material world, none of them are going to come to us just because we are practicing bhakti. But the practice of bhakti is what enables us to eventually become free from misery, and the practice of bhakti also enables us to tolerate misery. See, we are all, this whole material world is like an epidemic afflicted zone. And those who start practicing bhakti, those who come to Krishna's movement and start practicing bhakti, they are like people who are connected to the hospital. They get you treatment. Now, if there is an epidemic, then just the opportunity to get the treatment itself is a great blessing. It's a great privilege. But even when one is getting treatment, that does not mean immediately one's suffering is going to go away. The disease has been, if there's a disease has been chronic or the disease has been very severe, then even the people who are being treated, they may also suffer at that time. But there are two differences. One is that the people who are being treated, they are on the way to recovery. They are on the way to become free from misery. So like that, the devotees are also, they may be also miserable now, but they are on the way to freedom from misery. And secondly, when a doctor is there, the doctor doesn't just give medicines in terms of curative medicines, but often doctors also give painkillers. So painkillers means that those, they don't take away the pain. It's painkiller is actually is a wrong word. It's a misnomer. It doesn't actually kill pain. It just covers the pain. At least at that time, because of pain medicine, the patient gets some relief. So like that, in the sadhaka's life also, the remembrance of Krishna is the ultimate cure, but can also be a painkiller. we may be suffering a lot, but if we absorb ourselves in the remembrance of Krishna, we do experience some amount of relief from bodily pain, from bodily distress. And in this way, we move closer to Krishna. So we can tolerate whatever sufferings come in our life, and we can eventually transcend the sufferings of material existence. So Krishna's primary mercy comes in the form of the opportunity to practice devotional service. Apart from that, when certain miseries come, it is not that Krishna is causing those miseries. Our own karma is causing, and Krishna may let those miseries come upon us because that is what is required right now for us. That becomes the impetus for us to practice bhakti more seriously, to shed our attachments. We don't know what Krishna's plan exactly is. But broadly, it is not, if we start expecting Krishna's mercy in terms of relief from the miseries of material existence, that expectation will not be fulfilled. We will all get sufferings, but if we understand the mercies primarily in terms of the process to become free from misery, then we can wholeheartedly take the process, and then yes, Krishna does help us. But even the material miseries can also be minimized by Krishna. But that is not the primary expectation that we should have from bhakti, while practicing bhakti. Does it answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, please. Yes.
How does the fourth principle of karma of course, the two principles of the and the mercy? So, main emphasis that the other principles are kind of complementary. Two principles are complementary. But can we say that at any point of time, mercy can never be complementary? Or, the Krishna is true, whatever it is mercy. But, as a common concept, as we are living in the present world, how that could be seen? Like, mercy is upheld always.
So is it that the other four other legs of dharma may be sometimes violated, but mercy, the principle of mercy is never violated? The word violated is not appropriate. It is one principle may be subordinated to another principle. So, violation means something is rejected. Subordinated means one is put down for something else. So, not necessarily compromised. It is just that in that particular situation, another principle may be more important. So, for example, we see that in the Mahabharata war, the Mahabharata itself, Krishna gives abundant opportunity to Duryodhana. He himself goes a Shanti Duta. And Shanti Duta, he very eloquently and fervently tries to petition for peace. But eventually, when it doesn't work out and the war takes place, at that time, finally on the 18th day, Duryodhana is killed. At that time, Duryodhana starts shouting at Krishna. He says, "I saw what you did. You know, you signaled to Bhima, and Bhima, that's why Bhima hit me below the waist. So you have won unfairly." So at that time, Krishna is quite harsh. Krishna is not at all apologetic, saying to say, no, what I did was, he says, "You did so much wrong, you deserved this. I gave you so many chances, and you did not accept any of those chances. So that you have got simply what you deserve, and now you are going to die a miserable death." So if we hear that voice of Krishna, it can seem very unmerciful at that point. But you know, that he was so incorrigible at that time. You know, he was so utterly unreformable. He had no desire to reform Duryodhana. So then Krishna punished him at that time. So, Krishna's, what we can say is, Krishna is always our well-wisher. But as a well-wisher, how he will act, sometimes he will act in a way that upholds, makes the principle of Satya as primary. Sometimes he may act in such a way that the principle of Shuchi may be primary. Sometimes it may be in such a way that the principle of Daya may be primary, mercy may be primary. But at other times, some of these principles may be subordinated for some other purpose. So Krishna is omnibenevolent. Omnibenevolent means he always does the good of everyone. But while doing good of others, sometimes truthfulness may have to be subordinated. Sometimes even mercifulness, it may seem to be subordinated. See, so there is the external action that may be seen which to be not merciful. But the intention is always benevolent. Intention is always merciful. But in the, so if we say that the principle of mercy is never subordinate, is never subordinated, then Krishna killing the demons. We can say at ultimate level that is mercy because the demons get liberated. But at immediate level, he's not forgiving them. He's punishing them. He's killing them. So a challenge in life is that when we understand certain principles, we may make one principle as the all-important principle. But life is subtle. And sometimes one principle may have to be subordinate to another principle. So in terms of intention, Krishna's mercifulness is never violated. Krishna is always, but rather than using the word mercy, when we use the word mercy specifically, mercy is contrasted with justice. Justice means you get what you deserve. Mercy means you get what you don't deserve. So Krishna always does good to others. Sometimes he does good by giving mercy. Sometimes he does good by giving justice. So when he punishes the demon, that is justice. That is not mercy in the literal sense when it is contrasted with justice. Are you understanding this difference between the two? Mercy means when a person is not punished for what they are doing, they are forgiven. Justice means they are punished. Whether Krishna gives justice or Krishna gives mercy, in both situations he does good to others. So in that sense, he is always omnibenevolent. But his benevolence may not always manifest as mercy as opposed to justice. Sometimes it may manifest as mercy and sometimes it may manifest as justice. Does that answer your question? Yes. So how are the Yamadutas taking the soul?
So the souls, I mean, the Yamadutas are taking the soul, and he also doesn't want to go.
Naturally.
So what is exactly meaning of immovable?
If the soul is immovable, then how do the Yamadutas drag the soul away? Yeah, achala means that the same Bhagavad Gita which says that the soul is achaloyam sanadana, that also says urdhvam gacchanti sattvastha madhye tishtanti rajasa jaganyaguna vrittistha adho vachinyamani. It also talks about the soul going up, soul going down, soul staying here itself. So that the soul moves is very clear. So immovable is not like an absolute eternal reality. And the soul is absolutely immovable. It basically means that if we say the whole section, that second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, it is differentiating between matter and spirit by describing how spirit has qualities which are opposite to that of matter. Nahanyate hanyamanesha. The body is destructible, soul is not destructible. Body changes, the soul doesn't change. Avyaktoyam, aikaryoyam, achintyoyam. So basically the focus of that section is to describe how the characteristics of spirit are not just different from, but in many ways opposite to that of matter. So in that sense, we have to look at what achala means. So the Bhagavad Gita uses the word chanchala for describing the mind. The mind is constantly restless. It is constantly swinging, moving here, moving there. The mind is also a part of matter. It's subtle matter. The soul is achala. Soul is achala means the soul is not fickle or movable the way matter is movable. Now, soul of course has free will, and by its free will, it can be moved. So, the immovability has to be seen in the context of it being is a contradictory characteristic to the characteristic of matter. And specifically with respect to Yamadutas, it is described that the Yamadutas, the Yamapasha, see the Atma is spiritual. The spiritual Atma cannot be caught by any material Pasha. Yamapasha is also material. Yamapasha catches the subtle body. And they drag the Yamadutas around the subtle body. And the soul is attached to the subtle body. And because the soul is attached to the subtle body, the soul goes to the subtle body. So it's like, you know, if a person is watching TV. And the person is so caught in watching the TV, some thief comes and starts stealing away the TV. The person is so caught in watching the TV, the thief is taking away the TV and the person goes after the thief. Not to stop the thief, but to keep watching the TV. So like that, the soul is attached to the subtle body. When you start taking the subtle body, the soul is not even aware that I have an existence separate from the subtle body. So there is identification with the gross body, but there is even greater identification with the subtle body. So because of that identification with the subtle body, when the subtle body is dragged by the Yamadutta, the soul also goes with it. Yamapash acts on the subtle body. Yes. So, Chakravarti Pad quotes Srila Swami's commentary that just by caring for his son, whom he addresses Narayan, Ajami developed bhakti. Yeah, the word bhakti is used differently in different contexts. At one level, bhakti can refer to parabhakti. At another level, bhakti can refer even to just a favorable disposition towards Krishna. It's a positive disposition towards Krishna. That can also refer to bhakti. Inclination to serve Krishna for whatever reason, that can also be called as bhakti. So here we will see that clearly that Ajamil had not developed pure devotion. If he had developed pure devotion, then he would just have been liberated and Vishnudas could have taken him back to God at that time. But what they did was they gave him a second chance. And in that second chance he redeemed himself. So one thing is, from the whole story if you see, it's clear he has not developed pure devotion. So what he has developed is a positive attraction towards Vishnu. And as a Brahmana, in general, Brahmanical culture had that attraction towards Vishnu. So we could say that even from his life, just by calling Narayan, by serving Narayan, by addressing the name Narayan, whatever he had learned earlier in his life, whatever he had done also slightly, earlier Jamil is defined more as a Brahmana than as a Bhakta. When we look at his qualities as we come forward, the qualities stress more about his Brahminical qualities. But it is not that he is ignorant about bhakti. That is not his focus, as we, in his character that is described. It is not the primary quality that is described. But it is not that he was not like Shukracharya, who was against Vishnu in any way. He was not siding with the demons or as a Brahmana of the demons. He was a Sushila Sampanna, a good Brahmana. And as a part of the Brahmanical culture, there is understanding of bhakti also. So that was revived by his utterance of the name of Narayan. So it is we cannot really talk about where it was in the analytical scale which say Rupa Goswami gives. Was he at the which level was he among the nine stages? Unless the Acharyas give specifically a commentary. If the Acharyas give this analytical framework later and the Bhagavatam gives this particular stage earlier. So usually what is explained by Bhaktivinoda Thakur also that and we will see that in Jilatan Chakravarti Pad's commentary also that this is not Namapra, that is Namabhas. It is not what he chants was not Shuddhanam, it is not Apradhanam also, it is Namabhas. And it is Namabhas because he did not call out to his son just to be saved for his sins. It was just an involuntary calling out off to his son, and that son's name was Narayan, and he remembered Narayan also. So it was not motivated as a counter to sinful activity. It was just an instinctive call for help under a desperate situation. And because there was no offensive intent, so it was not Apradhanam. And certainly he did not have pure heart, so it was not Shuddhanam. So it became Namavas. And later on, by the religious sadhana that he did, then he came from the stage of Namavas, which had saved him at that time, to the stage of Shuddhanam, where he became purified and ultimately liberated. Does that answer your question?
Practicing sadhana, sadhaka, I also understand that I am also chanting in a
So, if outside people also sometimes as a part of the culture, they may chant the names of Vishnu, Krishna, and we also chant. They are also Namabhas, they are also Namabhas. What is the difference? Yeah, so Namabhas is, it's not just like one thin line, it's a broad level. We could say it that, you know, there are people who don't know shooting arrow at all. They shoot anywhere. And there are people who are shooting an arrow which they are trying to hit at the target. So now, after a long practice, the arrow will hit the target. So now, what we are doing is, we are practicing for the arrow to hit the target. The others are just shooting arrows. They are not really practicing with the intent of hitting any target. They are not necessarily cultivating a pure heart by the practice of bhakti. Their focus is just, it's a part of their culture, they may do it, and they may also have some devotion. It is not that only by sadhana bhakti, or only those who follow the ISKCON standards of sadhana bhakti, they are serious bhaktas. Others may also be bhaktas. We have to see what they are practicing. But it is to rise from namabhas to shuddha nam requires time, requires effort. And we see Ajami put in that effort. This is at the age of 88, this happened to him. But then it is for several years, more than a decade, he practiced serious sadhana bhakti. And then he became pure and he became liberated. So what we are doing is sadhana bhakti, to rise from the state of namabhas to shuddhana. So others are not trying also to rise from namabhas to shuddhana. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? So if dharma is a principle, then how is that different from a belief system? See, the word belief system usually connotes something which people believe in. Whether it is true or not, the connotation is that it is not true, but this is what you believe in. But it may be, but the focus is on what we believe. Whereas when we talk about principles, it is on what is the reality. We talk about principles, they are universal principles. So in belief system, the focus is on what people believe. In principles, the focus is on what is the reality. So now, even within Krishna consciousness, it is not that all of us have exactly the same belief system. Our Shraddha, it is shaped by many other factors. Many different factors. We have broad faith in some principles, but within that, our specific kind of faith, each of us will have different, and that is perfectly understandable. So, all of us can have, even in the spiritual world, Yashodamai doesn't conceive Krishna the same way as Radharani conceives Krishna. So, her conception of Krishna is different. So, that variety in conception is perfectly okay. There are broad principles in terms of actions and reactions. Certain actions will produce certain reactions. We need to act in ways that don't harm others. We need to act in ways which are ultimately meant to serve God. The specifics will vary. And if we become too obsessed with variations and specifics, then we don't have to go even outside the Vedic culture. Even in the Vedic culture itself, they have such multi-level spirituality. Now we talk about following the four regulative principles. But there are Shakta worshippers, there are Shaivite worshippers. They don't follow the four regulative principles. But they are also within the Vedic fold. So when you talk about principles, it is, even principles are not like, rather than thinking of dharma as, you know, this is right and this is wrong as a principle, we understand the principles are also progressive. So it's like dharma is a set of concentric circles. And they're all concentric circles which are meant to ultimately take us towards pure devotion. But different people may be in circles of different radii. So some people may be centered on Krishna, but they may be relatively much further away from Krishna. They may be just following some principle at some level. But those who are following serious principle, they are closer towards Krishna. So the variety in practice does not mean relativity in principle. Variety in practice is that different people are at different levels of consciousness. They are at different levels of spiritual evolution. And thus, they can practice bhakti in different ways. But the variety in practice does not, it does not mean relativity in principle. That means everything is relative, there is no absolute truth. The two are different things. The variety in practice indicates God's accommodating nature. Now, according to time, place, circumstance, He reveals Himself in different ways. He gives people principles that they can practice and by which they can gradually become elevated. So, variety in practice does not mean relativity in principle. That means not everything is relative. You believe this is right, I believe that is right, and that is right for you, that is right for me. No. There is a process for spiritual elevation, and we have to see if a person claims that they are devoted to God, then what are the characteristics that they are devoted to God? Are they detached from other things? Are they practicing spiritual life sincerely? And there are objective criteria which we can also observe. So, but the nature of this world is not everybody can practice the same principles with the same level of seriousness. And everybody has to accommodate it. Na buddhi bhedam janayet ajnanam karma sanginam. Yoshayet sarva karmani vidvan yukta samachar. That people are of different natures and don't disturb their mind. Just engage them on the progressive path. Does it address your question? Any other questions? Shall we move on? Yes, please.
Here, Issa Satana Vivya, did it indicate that the Yamadutas books about
bhakti? Okay. So here, when it is said Isha Sangha Viliyate, does that mean the Yamadutas know about bhakti? Yes and no. The specific point is that they know that there is a process for liberation, and that is Isha Sangha, that is something about to do with God, something about devotion. They also know Narayan. But the specific glory of bhakti, and specifically the glory of the holy name, and even more specifically the glory of one utterance of the holy name, all this they don't know. So as a broad understanding, they know this is the way to liberate, this is the way to freedom or liberation. But the specifics and the glory of this process of bhakti, that they don't know. And that Yamaraj will enlighten them about later. So, shall we move on? We have a text 56. Ayam Nishuta Sampannaha Shila Vritta Gunalayaha Rutavato Mrutur Dantaha Satyavan Mantra Vichuchihi Guru Agnya Atiti Vriddhanam Shushvushur Anahankutaha Sarvabhuta Surut Sadhur Mita Vak Anasuyakaha. So here, from here onwards, the Yamadutas describe why Ajamil is punishable. And while describing that, why he is punishable, they start by describing. So here, it's like a backstory. Sometimes, you know, in a novel or a movie, it starts in the middle of action. And then it goes to backstory. Okay, this is what happened in the past. So like that, here there's a backflash or a backstory that is being described. How Ajamil was earlier and how he became degraded. Shuta Sampannaha. So he's well learned. Shila Gupta. And it was not just theoretical learning. It also his behavior is also good. Shila Gupta Gunalaya. Alaya means like a reservoir, a boat. So he had many good qualities. He was well behaved. Rutavrato Mrudu Danta. He was determined, would follow vows. Mrudu, gentle, Danta, self-controlled. Satyavan Mantra Vichuchi. He was truthful, he used to chant the mantras, he was clean. And then Shushushur Anahankrita. He used to serve without an ego the gurus, the sacred fire, the guests, and the elderly. And not only that, he was the well-wisher of all. Sarvabhut Surudha Sadhu. He was a good person. Mitavagana Suyaka, non-envious. And he was regulated. He was controlled in speech. Mitavag. He was gentle. So he was basically very well-behaved. And this set of qualities which I described, they actually are set to illustrate, you know, how powerfully the force of degradation can work. That even for a person who is so elevated, that person can also get degraded. This is the setting now. Ekadasavanam yataha Pitra Sandesh Krudvijaha
Pitra Sandesh Krudvijaha
Adaya Tata Avrittaha
Adaya Tata Avrittaha
Phala Pushpa Samit Kushan
Phala Pushpa Samit Kushan.
So, here is stated that one day Ekadasavanam yataha, he went to his forest. His father had told him to get something for the fire sacrifice. So, flowers, fruits, kushagras, he went out to get that. And while he was coming, when he was coming back, at that time, something momentous happened. Tadarishakami naam kanche, chudram saha bujishaya,
chudram saha bujishaya,
pitva cha
madhumaireyam,
Madaghurnitanetraya. So, while he was coming back, he saw Dadarsha Kamina. Kama is lust. Kami is a lusty person. He saw Kanchi. He saw some lusty person. Chu was a Chudra. And Saha Bhujishyaya. Bhujishyaya refers to a prostitute. He was the prostitute. And he had drunk Madhu. Madhu can mean honey. Madhu can mean alcohol. It basically means he was intoxicated. He was under Madhugurunita Netra, his eyes were rolling. So basically the idea is that this person was completely stupid in the enjoyment. So like people may go to a party and they drink and then they do all sorts of things. So like this. And Mattaya Vishlathan Nivya Vyapetam Nirapatrapam
Vyapetam Nirapatrapam
Kridantam anugayantam Hasantam anayantike. So, Mattaya, he was intoxicated and that woman, the prostitute was there, she was Vishlathan, her clothes were scattered. So, she was in a state of undress. Vyapetam nirapatram, nirapatrapam, that means they were this sort of activities are not to be done in public, but they were shamelessly, brazenly doing this in public, kridantam, and not only they were doing this in public view, but they were also, it's not that they were doing it silently. They were dancing, they were singing, kridantam anugayantam, and he was laughing, asandam anayantike. So he was coming back from the forest, in the forest, along this, he saw the scene of sense enjoyment. Now, there is sense gratification, which is basically a fact of material existence. And the devatas also engage in sense gratification. But the difference between devatas and asuras is the devatas engage in sense gratification within the precincts of dharma. The asuras violate the principles of dharma. And if we see, even in the past, there were prostitutes. And it is, we see Narada is said to be the son of a Dasi Putra. Narada in a very early pious age. That means at that time also there are prostitutes and there are men who use prostitutes and then they abandon the prostitutes. So, this kind of people will always be there. But the big difference in Kali Yuga is that sin is always there in the world. But in Kali Yuga, sin is glamorized. That is what makes Kali Yuga especially dangerous. People are always going to do sinful activities. But in the past, you know, if somebody had to smoke, they would go to some private place and they would smoke or they would drink. Now, people do it in public view. In fact, not only people do it in public view on television and movies, it's broadcasted for everyone else to see also. So, this glamorization of sin, what it does is, it blunts people's moral sensibilities. It is one thing, there is right, and moral sensibility means the awareness what is right and what is wrong. And there are, even after knowing what is right, what is wrong, there are people who may do wrong things. And that there are that kind of people always in the world. But when there is public glamorization of sin, people start thinking, this is not bad. What for it being bad? It is good. This is fashionable. This is cool. This is what I should be doing. So the glamorization of sin blunts people's moral sensibilities. people's moral compass becomes disoriented. So in today's world, you know, the only sin, sex is not considered sinful. Sex is not considered wrong. The only sin is if you do sex without consent. If a man rapes a woman, that is considered to be like an unforgivable crime. Now everybody makes a big UN cry. Now of course there is that is very brutal thing to do. But the point is that here today the consent is made the sole ground for sex. And nothing else is considered as any factor of importance. Whether people are married, what is the purpose, what is the consciousness, all that is not considered at all. So what has happened is the moral landscape has become very blurred. Because of the glamorization of sin, there is no sense of what is right or what is wrong. If it feels right for me, if it feels right for you, if both of us want it, let's do it. So at that time, as Prabhupada also explains in his purports here, as well as in Second Chance, that this kind of scene, it was not something which people would see normally. It was an exception, it was a terrible exception. And in that sense, Ajamila is unfortunate that he saw it. Of course, after he saw it, he contemplated and he fell down. That was the way he let those thoughts dwell, that we'll see afterwards. But the point is that this glamorization of sin is very dangerous. And we live in Kali Yuga. See, there is also a certain level of deadening to sensuality that happens. You know, when people are exposed to a lot of sensually agitating stimuli, then they become deadened to it. Deadened to it means, you know, if we see, especially if you go to the Western world, there people dress very sparsely. But it is not that people are in a constant state of intolerable sexual agitation. Everybody is sexually agitated. Everybody engages in sexual sense gratification. But when everybody is dressing sparsely, people get used to it. And then it is not that they get constantly agitated by that. So there is a, what we get habituated to, then later on, if somebody is not habituated that, they get very agitated by that. If somebody is habituated that, it is not that they are pure. It is not that they are not going to get agitated. But they need a much grosser stimuli for agitation. For a person who has pure consciousness, who is not exposed to much sensory stimuli, even a little sensory stimuli agitates. But for people who are regularly exposed to agitating stimuli, for them, you know, they need a very, very gross stimuli to get agitated. Just a couple, 1.5 months ago, there was an article in Times. And Times of America, the big cover story, it came in New York Times also. It was a new threat to virility. Virility is male sexuality. What was that threat? That was that there is a whole growing movement among youth, young males, against porn. Now, what has happened is for last two decades, increasingly pornographic content is available to people. And by seeing all kinds of sexuality through porn, now, what happens when the people see something online, there they are all sort of exaggerated, distorted, fantasized kinds of sexual enjoyment is depicted. And these people, they found that after seeing all that in real life, they don't get agitated only, they don't get excited only. And they want to give up porn, not because they are agitating against porn, not because they are pure heart, because they feel this pornography is indulging with a real sex life. So they are against it. So the point which I am making through all this is that actually how much, what kind of sexuality a person is exposed to, that creates a kind of deadening of a person's sensibilities. And then, so when they are exposed to exaggerated levels of sensuality, then in real life whatever they are exposed to, that doesn't excite them, that doesn't turn them on, and they feel, I am not able to enjoy life. So, in the material world, we, especially when we live in cities, now of course you are not living in cities, but here also, we are exposed to sensory stimuli and we can't avoid that exposure. But what we can do is, we can avoid contemplation on that. So, initially when we see some sight, we may get agitated. But if over a period of time, it is something similar, we get habituated to it, not in the sense that we contemplate on it. But we see this is the way people dress, we get used to it. And then there is a deadening happens. Now, of course, the deadening won't happen if we keep contemplate. The problem is not just perception of the senses. The problem is imagination based on perception. After we see something, we imagine something. And only when we imagine, then there is a problem. So what happens with these people who have become addicted to porn? You know, porn has already depicted everything that they have imagined. So now in real life, there is nothing to imagine only. And that's why there is no agitation, there is no excitement. For them, they feel it is excitement and enjoyment. For us, because we want to avoid it, we call it agitation. But either way, whether it is excitement or is it agitation, it is all functions based on imagination. So, we cannot avoid perception. And based on, so what happened if we are utterly unexposed to certain sensory perceptions, then when there are certain sights of people dressed a little less or whatever, then it excites our imagination. But when we don't let the imagination get excited, then gradually we get habituated to that level of perception. See, habituation is not purification. The two are different things. Habituation means that that level of sensory perception has become commonplace, and that's why one doesn't get agitated by that. Purification means the desires themselves are not there. When there is habituation, the desires are still there. But those desires, because that level of perception is commonplace, so one does not get agitated by that perception. Other perceptions may still agitate, especially when one imagines, one may still get agitated. So, based on the place where we are living, we may have to habituate ourselves to a certain level of perception. So, the habituation comes when the perception is anyway there, but we don't contemplate on it, we don't imagine based on it. And we cannot blame people. No, people are dressing like this, what can I do? No, we have to habituate ourselves. See, purification will take time for us. But habituation means that we don't let ourselves get imagine things. Once we don't imagine things, then gradually there is habituation that happens to that perception, and then the agitation goes down. Now, for that matter, you know, if somebody wants to get agitated, you know, even no perception can agitate also. If we just want to imagine, we can imagine what we may have seen or thought or heard earlier. We can recollect that and we can agitate ourselves also. But the important thing is we regulate our imagination. We avoid our imagination, then this whole degradation of consciousness that happens, that can be avoided. So here, Ajamil saw this sight, and we'll see in the next verses how he got into trouble because of that. 61. Drishtva tam kam liptena, bahuna parirambhitam, jagam ruchaya vasham, sahasaiva vimohitah. Drishtva tam kam liptena, on seeing those people kam liptena, engaged in intoxicated by lust, bahuna parirambhitam, this man was embracing that woman, and jagam ruchaya vasham, so at that time awakened with his heart, ruchaya, what was the desire that was there in the heart, it not only awakened, but it conquered him, consumed him, he went under its control, vasham, he became controlled by it, sahasaiva vimohitaha, suddenly he became deluded. See, our desires are not just linear, our desires are triangular also. What does it mean? Linear desire means, see, I am here, my senses are here, the object is there. I see the object and I get agitated and I start getting the desire. I want to enjoy it. That is, we say linear desire. But our desires, much more linear, they are triangular. Triangular means, I am here, the object is there. But there is another person who is somewhere else. And I see that person enjoying the object. And then I see that object, I see that person enjoying that object, and then there is a triangle that is formed. So by seeing others enjoy, we get the desire to enjoy. By seeing the objects also, we may get desire to enjoy, but by seeing others enjoy, that enjoyment becomes, the desire to enjoy becomes much more forceful. And so this triangularity of desires is what is critical to understanding the power of association. So if now lust was there in his heart, Ajamil's heart, lust is there in all of our hearts also. But what happened was, not just he saw a prostitute, he saw a man enjoying with this woman, with the prostitute. And that kindled his desire. So to a large extent, if we avoid bad association, which does not trigger the triangularity of desires, then the linear desires that come up, they are to a large extent controllable. If we associate with materialistic people and then think that I will not engage in sense gratification, that is very difficult. If we associate with people who are constantly, say, doing a particular activity and then we say, I won't do it, the triangularity of desires will impel us to do that activity. And this triangularity of desires is actually even more critical in bhakti. Because it is by the association of devotees that our devotional desires get awakened. Now, we may, because of our pious upbringing or whatever, we go to temple and maybe fold our hands, stand there for a moment, and then come back and leave the temple and go away. But if we see, if we come to the association of devotees, then we see devotees dancing and singing jubilantly, sometimes for a long, long time. When they do, when we see them doing that, at that time we say, what is this they are getting? The same deity I am also seeing, but seeing the deity, same, like earlier you mentioned, others also chant the holy names. But then devotees chant the holy names, they can chant it for hours and they get some special taste. What is this? So by seeing devotees relishing the holy name, by seeing devotees relishing the kirtan of the darshan of Krishna, by seeing devotees delighting in Shastra, we get the desire to delight in those manifestations. So that's why association of devotees is important for us to stimulate our devotional desires. So often just by taking darshan of the deities, we may not feel anything special. Sometimes if we ourselves start taking the Bhagavatam and start studying the Bhagavatam, usually the first thing that happens is we go not to transcendence but to ignorance. We quite often succumb to tamoguna and we go to sleep or we feel lethargic. But if we associate with devotees who have great taste for Bhagavatam and then they have studied the Bhagavatam, they appreciate the Bhagavatam and they speak in the Bhagavatam, then what happens is, hey, I never knew this point could be understood. This could be understood this way. I never thought this way. So we may not get Navanavarasa Dhaman, we may not get new taste in terms of absorption in Krishna directly, in new mellows and remembrance of Krishna. But in the association of devotees, we can develop taste for understanding Shastra, analyzing Shastra in different ways, and appreciating it. So this principle of the triangularity of desires, we can tap when we practice bhakti. And thus we can move closer towards Krishna. So here, this principle of triangularity of desires drag Ajamil down. And thus, sahasaiva vimohitaha, he became denuded. 62. Stambayan atmanatmanam. Yavat sattvam yathashrutam.
Yavat sattvam yathashrutam.
Nashashaka samadhatum.
Nashashaka samadhatum.
Mano madana vepitam.
Mano madana vepitam.
So madana vepitam, his mind was agitated by the arrows of Cupid. So lust was triggered there. Stambayan atmanatmanam. So when he was going into illusion like this, he tried to control his mind. Atmanatmanam, with his intelligence, he tried to control the mind. Yavat sattvam yathashrutam, as per his nature, as per what he had heard, he tried to control. Nashashaka samadhatum, but it was not possible for him to control. So what happened here is, that if we see to 2.60, the Bhagavad Gita, what it says is, yatato yapi kaunteya purushasya upaschita indriyani pramathini haranti pasavamana. Now this verse is not talking about sense gratifiers succumbing to sensual desires. It is talking about transcendentalists or serious people. Yatato, they are endeavoring. And further, purushasya vipaschita. So two describers Krishna uses. They are endeavoring and vipaschita. They also have intelligence. So, they have that intention to want to control the senses and they also have the intelligence by which they understand this is right and this is wrong. But still, indriyani pramathini haranti pasamamana. So just intelligence or intention, these two alone are not enough. Both of them are important, both of them are also essential. But in mathematics, we have necessary but not sufficient condition. So like that, we have to, whatever intelligence we have to use that intelligence properly. And we have to make our resolutions, we have to have the intention of becoming pure. But just our intelligence and our intention are not enough. What we need is devotion. So this verse says, even such people get carried away. But the next verse, 2.61, states that తాని సర్వాణి సంయమ్య యుక్త ఆసీత్ మత్పర వశేహి అస్య ఇంద్రియాణి తస్య ప్రజ్ఞా ప్రతిష్ఠిత దట్ దోస్ హూ మత్పర దోస్ హూ ఫిక్స్ దర్ కాన్షియస్నెస్ ఆన్ మీ దే బికమ్ ప్యూరిఫైడ్ దే అటైన్ దెన్ దే ఆర్ ఏబుల్ టు కంట్రోల్ ద సెన్సెస్ సో హియర్ హీ హ్యాడ్ ద ఇంటెన్షన్ హీ హ్యాడ్ ద ఇంటెలిజెన్స్ బట్ అట్ దిస్ పర్టిక్యులర్ పాయింట్ హీ డిడ్ నాట్ హ్యావ్ డివోషన్ హీ డిడ్ నాట్ స్ట్రైవ్ టు రిమెంబర్ కృష్ణ హీ వాజ్ రిమెంబరింగ్ స్క్రిప్చర్ బట్ ఇన్ స్క్రిప్చర్ ఆల్సో దెర్ ఇస్ లాట్ ఆఫ్ థింగ్స్ అల్టిమేట్లీ వేదైష్య సర్వై అహమేవ వేద్యో వి రిమెంబర్ స్క్రిప్చర్ సో దాట్స్ వి రిమెంబర్ కృష్ణ అండ్ సమ్ సర్టన్లీ క్యాన్ రిమెంబర్ స్క్రిప్చురల్ వర్సెస్ టు కౌంటర్ ద సెన్షువల్ డిజైర్స్ బట్ అల్టిమేట్లీ ఇట్ ఈస్ స్క్రిప్చురల్ వర్సెస్ ఆర్ మెంట్ టు రిమైండర్స్ ఆఫ్ కృష్ణ అండ్ ఇస్ రిమెంబరెన్స్ ఆఫ్ కృష్ణ దట్ ఇస్ అల్టిమేట్ ప్రొటెక్టర్ సో అట్ దిస్ పాయింట్ హీ వాజ్ యూజింగ్ ఇస్ ఇంటెలిజెన్స్ అండ్ ఇంటెన్షన్ బట్ యాజ్ ద భగవత్ ఇట్ సెల్ఫ్ ప్రెడిక్ట్స్ ఇట్ ఈస్ నాట్ ఇనఫ్ 63 తన్నిమిత్తస్మర వ్యాజ గ్రహ గ్రహగ్రస్తో విచేతనః తామేవ మనసా ధ్యాయన్ స్వధర్మాద్ విరరామః విరరామః హి గేవ్ ఇట్ అప్ స్వధర్మ హిజ్ ఓన్ ధర్మ హి గేవ్ ఇట్ అప్ హౌ తాన్ నిమిత్త స్మర వ్యాజ సో last awakened within his consciousness because of this cause and he contemplated tameva manasadhyaya he contemplated on it so contemplation here means see the word contemplation it can mean serious philosophical thought also but contemplation can also mean we just think and we imagine so here it means dhyaya means it was not like meditation it was just the imagination so the imagination because of that things went out of control and గ్రహగ్రస్తో విచేతన ప్రభుపాద్ సేన్ జస్ట్ లైక్ ఎక్లిప్స్ వెన్ ఇట్ కమ్స్ దెన్ ద మూన్ ఆర్ ద సన్ దే గెట్ కవర్డ్ సో లైక్ దాట్ హిస్ ధర్మ హిస్ ధార్మిక్ ప్రిన్సిపల్స్ అడియరెన్స్ టు ధర్మ దాట్ గాట్ కవర్డ్ బికాస్ దిస్ డిజైర్ బికేమ్ వెరీ స్ట్రాంగ్ ఇన్ హిస్ కాన్షియస్నెస్ సో ద బెస్ట్ టైమ్ టు విన్ ద వార్ అగేన్స్ట్ టెంప్టేషన్ ఇస్ బిఫోర్ ఇట్ బిగిన్స్ దట్ మీన్స్ Don't let the imagination grow itself. Don't let the temptation come in the consciousness itself. Once the temptation comes, it will start growing, 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 growing. And then it will be more and more difficult to defeat it. We all know the chariot horse metaphor, the chariot body metaphor, in which the intelligence is the charioteer. Now, if a horse starts going in the wrong direction, at that time, the charioteer is alert and Chariot pulls the horse back. Then it's relatively easy to control. But if the horse starts running and the horse gains momentum, then after that, the charioteer may have to get up and pull with the full strength. And sometimes even that may not be enough later on. So, the earlier the horse wrong moment is curbed, the better it is. Once the horse gets momentum, it will become increasingly difficult to control. Of course, it is never irreversible. Even if the horse goes off track and the chariot gets overturned, then after the chariot can be turned back on, brought back on track and one can move on. But it's a much more troublesome process. So here, as the momentum of desires was becoming stronger, Ajamil couldn't check it. And as Swadharma Viraram, his dharmic principle, adherence to dharmic principles, it was lost. Tameva toshayamasa. ప్రిత్యేనార్థేన యావత పిత్రేనార్థేన యావత గ్రామ్యైర్మనోరమై కామై ప్రసీదేత యథా తథా సో హౌ హీ గేవ్ హిస్ ప్రాక్టీస్ గివ్ అప్ హిస్ ప్రాక్టీస్ ఆఫ్ ధర్మ దట్ ఇస్ మెన్షన్ ఇన్ దిస్ వర్స్ దట్ హీ యాక్చువల్లీ కాల్ ద ప్రాస్టిట్యూట్ అండ్ ఇట్ ఇస్ నాట్ జస్ట్ దట్ హీ indulge in that prostitute once, but he actually started living with her. And now he had to maintain her. She was a prostitute. She could go to any man, whoever would give her money. Now for a prostitute, if she is to stay with one man, that man has to please her a lot. That man has to give her a lot of things. Otherwise, she has no vows of faithfulness that are going to keep her. So he had to please her so that she would stay with him. And for pleasing her, first what did he do? Pitrenarthena. He had some money from his parents. And he took that money and he spent it. As much money was there, he took it all and he used it. to satisfy Gramer Manoramai Kamai, mundane sensual pleasures. He gave her food, he gave her ornaments, he gave her dresses, whatever it was. And in that way he tried to please her. So he lost all, almost all the father's and property was there, he lost it all, he squandered it all. And after that what happened? Vipram Swabharyayam Apraudham. So Vipram Swabharyam Apraudham.
Vipram Swabharyam Apraudham.
Kule Mahatilam Vitam.
Kule Mahatilam Vitam.
Visasarjachirat Papah. Swairinyapanga Vidhadhi. So, his own Swabharya, his own wife was there, Aprauda. She was not old, she was young. That means she was also good looking, she was beautiful. And not only was she beautiful, Kule Mahati Lambitam. She was actually from an elevated family. He was a Brahmana, so probably his wife was a Brahmini. She was also from a good family, but Visasaraja, he gave her up. Papaha, and with the sinful woman, Swairinya Vidhadhi, he started living with her. So she had been given to him by her father in a virtuous ceremony, but he gave it up. See, sometimes when we talk about lust, there is a tendency to depict all women in bad light. You know, women are temptresses and women are bad. Now, yes, for a brahmachari, we have to be careful about associating with women. But lust is such that, you know, lust doesn't just hurt men. You know, lust hurts women also. So here, when he was afflicted by this prostitute, what happened was, it was his wife, she was completely innocent. Now she was hurt, he rejected her. And now the Bhagavatam doesn't go into the narrative of what happened to her. So the point is that, actually, it is not a woman that is the enemy of man, it is the lust that is the enemy of man. So, when we start equating lust with women, that can become a problem. Because ultimately women are also souls. And they are also, especially if they are coming to the temple, they are also want to come closer to Krishna. So, we have to do what it takes to protect ourselves. But protecting ourselves does not mean blaming others. Yes, it's possible. See, women is also not like, just like there are men who are very lusty, there are men who are regulated. There are women also, some women are very lusty, some women are regulated. There are different kinds of women. So we cannot paint everyone in one brush. And in this particular pastime, we see there's one woman who was lusty and she sort of snagged Ajamil, but because of that another woman was also victimized. So the scripture, although sometimes the female is, Maya is portrayed as female, but it's understood, the Bhagavad Gita, I think in the 4th or 5th canto, it says that just as a woman is temptation for man, man is a temptation for woman. So in that sense, temptation is gender neutral. Temptation is not gender specific. Everybody gets tempted. And we have to do what it takes to protect ourselves from temptation. But we can't equate lust with women or blame women for lust that we may have. We protect ourselves, but in a non-judgmental, non-blaming way. Yatas tatas chopaninye.
Yatas tatas chopaninye.
Nyayato anyayato dhanam.
Nyayato anyayato dhanam.
Babhrasya kutumminya.
Babhrasya kutumminya.
Kutumbam mandadhirayam.
Kutumbam mandadhirayam.
So, what happened is, he somehow or the other, he would get money. Chopapanye. Nyayato anyayato dhanam. Some legally, illegally. Whatever it took. And Babhrasya kutumminya. He maintained his family. Mandadhi is, Jamil was foolish. And he maintained his family. Foolish because he was not seeing the consequences of his actions. He was not seeing the adharma that he was doing. And this way he maintained his family. See here, although from the Bhagavatam's perspective, Ajamil is very fallen. That, you know, he gave up his wife and started living with a prostitute. But if we consider today's culture, even Ajamil is actually a, you know, today people have live-in relationship where they don't get married only. Or people have one-night stands where they just come together one night, they enjoy, and then they go away. So here, he actually had a prostitute, and through it, even though he was aborting all the children, he begot the children, and he was maintaining them. So today, people are so degraded that quite often, as Prabhupada would say, you know, sometimes in the name of free sex, a man and woman unite, but then the man goes away, and the woman is abandoned. And then either she has to abort the child, or she has to become a single mother, and she has to maintain the child, which is also very difficult. So, no, today's culture is a culture of total aversion to commitment. Total aversion to commitment of any kind. People want enjoyment, but with no commitment at all. Not even the commitment of marriage, not even commitment of a long-term relationship. So Ajamil, even in that situation where he's very degraded, at least he was maintaining. Of course, he was maintaining his family by sinful means, and that was a degraded thing. His rejecting his earlier wife, that was a bad thing. His rejecting the Brahminical way of living, that is a bad thing. His plundering people is a bad thing. But still, even from today's perspective, today's culture, if we see the kind of sexual licentiousness that is there, that is, it's very bad. See, there have always been, as in the past, you know, in India, Indian culture, men would have, there would be polygamy, where men would have many women, wives, kings especially would have many wives, but they would maintain all of them. In the West also, men would have mistresses. Now they would have a legally wed wife, and then they would have some mistresses with whom they would live. But the mistresses also they would maintain. But, so this sex has always been something which is a rampant force. But there is always some understanding of some level of responsibility associated with it. But today, there is absolutely no sense of responsibility. Men don't have any sense of responsibility towards women, and women don't have any sense of responsibility towards the children, towards whatever child is born. So it's a culture of aversion to responsibility. And that makes it a very, very unfortunate culture. Very degraded, very unfortunate culture. So, yad asau shastram ullanghya, svair charya atigarhitaha, avartachiram kalam, aghayur ashuchir malat. So, in this way, shastram ullanghya, he was violating shastra, svair charya atigarhita, he was living with this svair chari, that is this prostitute. Avartata chiram kala, for a long time he was living, aghayur, he was living a sinful life, ashuchir, impure, and malat, it explained that he was eating the food cooked by this prostitute. So our consciousness is affected by the food that we eat, and who is cooking that food. So the food, now Prabhupada explains he was eating the food cooked by her. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says he is eating her remnants. So when people, they think that they are in love with each other, you know, they want to eat from each other's plates. So that's like taking the remnants of somebody. So he was doing that, and in this way his consciousness became very degraded. And then, so they have now described the narrative of how he became degraded, how he lived sinfully. Tata enam dandapanehe sakasham krutakilvisham Nesyamo akrita nirvesham,
Nesyamo akrita nirvesham,
Yatra dandena shudhyati,
Yatra dandena shudhyati.
So, therefore tatayenam dandapanehe. Dandapane means, in one whose hand the rod of chastisement that is there. Danda is chastisement or the rod of chastisement. Pane is hand. So that refers to Yamaraj, one who carries the rod of chastisement. Sakasham krita kilvisham. So he has krita kilvisham. He has done many sinful activities. And neshamo akruta nirvesham. That means akruta nirvesham means he has not done any atonement for his sins. And therefore, we have to give him danda. And yatra dandena. And the purpose of the danda is what? Shudhyati. It is not punishment for the sake of punishment. It is the punishment for the sake of purification. So they are saying that because he was like this, but he has become like this. He was dharmic, but he has become adharmic. And he has not done any atonement. Therefore, we are entirely justified in taking him for punishment to Yamaraj. And this is how this narrative concludes and what will happen, how the Vishnudas will respond and how the conversation will take place further, we'll discuss in tomorrow's class. Any questions? One or two questions quickly. Please.
Counselor is counseling about how a wife should behave in present scenario where a husband or a man is always bombarded with so many glamorous things. So he was mentioning that naturally a man, because he is always seeing so much glamour outside, so wife should also try to maintain, not to show a lot of dharmicness in her life, otherwise a man will give up her life and he will try to find something else. So he was trying to say that a woman should always dress nicely in a way that's pleasing to the husband.
Yeah.
In such a way that he will not try to look outside for some better place. So a little bit confusion here I'm at. The same thing that Kula Dharma can do, that the wife of Achami was not a very good Kula. So she may not be a supporting way to the Achami. She might have rejected his idea. That's
okay.
Why he went to the prosecutor or maybe something like that.
Okay. Okay.
I just wish to know that.
Okay. I got your question. So is it that, because men have lust in them, and especially in today's culture, say, and are exposed to so many sexually agitating stimuli also. So the wife should also dress attractively and look beautiful and not be too dharmic, so that the husband is attracted to her and not attracted to somewhere else. Yes, see, there are levels of dharma, and we have to understand that there is one problem that happens sometimes in ISKCON. It has happened a lot in ISKCON actually. We try to impose the monastic standard on everyone. Monastic standard is the monk standard, the brahmachari standard, the sannyasi standard. So the renunciate standard is for renunciates. That is not for householders. So, what does it mean? Prabhupada also says in the first canto and else many places also that a wife should dress very attractively when the husband is present, and when the husband is gone far away, the wife should not dress so attractively. That means the idea is the wife should not want to attract men other than one's husband. But the wife should serve her husband, and the wife should please the husband, the wife should attract the husband. So there are multiple levels that when we talk about the principle of no illicit sex, there is a huge difference between sex within marriage and sex outside marriage. It's a world of difference. And in general, I talk with many senior devotees about this. Prabhupada, whenever he has given initiation lectures, at that time, in the initiation lecture, when he talks about the regulative principle of illicit sex, he simply explains that no sex outside marriage. So, in his purports, in his lectures, he may talk about, within marriage also it should be for procreation. But that is not what Prabhupada usually talked about at the time of initiation. So the initiation vow is no sex outside marriage. See, if we start calling all sex as bad and then don't differentiate sex within marriage and sex outside marriage, actually extramarital sex can break families. It can cause havoc in society. Sex within marriage does not have that kind of effects. So what I'm trying to explain by this is, the monastic standard is, all sex should be avoided. But that is not the standard for householders. Householders can also try to rise to higher and higher standards. But there is a big, big difference. There is sex within marriage, you could put it in, there's illicit sex with a small I and illicit sex with a capital I. So illicit sex with a capital I means sex outside marriage. This is a small island, sex within marriage will not be for procreation. So the point is that there is a gradual process by which people become purified. And It is, so then actually this happened also, that in Mayapur there was some, during Prabhupada's time, there was some devotee who in Mayapur, who went to some prostitute, initially devotee. And then Prabhupada came to know about it. Prabhupada was quite upset. Prabhupada called the devotee and asked him. So he said, but you are married. He said, no, my wife wants to practice very strictly, so she refused. And then so Prabhupada told him, no, you have to have proper understanding. You, so a husband and wife, you know, they have to have proper understanding of what, how, what standard is mutually acceptable for both of them. So what this means is, see, in general, sannyasis and brahmacharis, they don't have to get into the nitty-gritties of people's personal lives. The husband and the wife have to have a relationship by which both of them can stably live in material life and progress in spiritual life. So whatever level that is, that will vary. Prabhupada also talked about other standards, you know, that there can be different levels. If you cannot follow between the age of 20 to 30 certain things, between the age of 30 to 40 certain things, 40 to 50 certain things. So there are various things, which, that is something which is to be decided by them. And so it is natural for a woman to dress attractively. And that's what women naturally want to do. And it's necessary for a woman who is married to attract her husband. So now, but there are two different things over here. See, the husband cannot rationalize one's adharma by quoting one's wife. There is, when we do something wrong, we are responsible. There may be circumstances which may impel us to do wrong. But still, ultimately the choice of doing wrong is ours. So, on the other hand, it is the wife also, basically the wife and the husband have to be understanding. There is no need to demonize sex. In the renounced order, see, what is the standard for renounced order, what is the standard for grahastha order, that is different. And if we demonize sex itself, it just, there is, in the materialistic culture, there is a romanticization, sex is romanticized, it is glamorized. When we go to the renounced order, we may demonize sex. But ultimately, sex is just a biological function. And what happens is, because of too much glamorization, it becomes a psychological obsession. It's a biological function. From a biological function, it becomes a psychological obsession. When it becomes a psychological obsession, then it becomes a major spiritual distraction. So, just like eating is a biological function. See, we say, ahar nidra bhay maithunam cha. We put them at one level in one category. But then another level we put Baithuna as something which is very bad. It's not, it's a biological function. And just as different people need different amounts of food. Some people may just eat 2 chapatis, some people may eat 10 chapatis. Now, that's their biological need. So the biological function based on a particular body may be different. And then we don't have to become judgmental. You eat 2 chapatis, you eat 10 chapatis. Because you eat 2 chapatis, you are a very advanced devotee. Or you eat 10 chapatis, you are a very low level dude. Not like that. It's a biological function. Each person will deal with it in a particular way. The important thing is that the biological function should not become a psychological obsession and a spiritual distraction. So how that is to be avoided, a person who is eating 10 chapatis is told to eat only 2 chapatis, is constantly thinking of food, then he cannot think about Krishna, he cannot serve Krishna. Then they need a particular level of food, eat that and move forwards. So like that, you know, within a family, you know, different, there is, just that there is physical, there is biological hunger, there is sexual hunger. There are people, psychologists call it sex drive. Some people have it more, some people have it, everybody has it, but some people have it more, some people have it less. So the husband and the wife have to come to a mutual understanding. And then, both of them, even when they are devotees, it is not that overnight they are going to become purified. It may take time. And the important thing is that the husband and wife, they should not be adversarial. You know, it's not that, you know, they are partners. Both of them have lust. And lust is a thing which they have to deal with. So how they deal with, they'll have to work it out individually. See, if spiritual standards are made into weapons in domestic ego battles, then family marriage becomes a nightmare. You understand what I'm saying? Spiritual. Okay. Spiritual standards are made into weapons in domestic ego battles. Domestic ego battles means what? You know, everybody, the husband thinks, you know, I am superior, I am the boss. The wife thinks, I am the boss. So the ego battle between the two. And then the spiritual standard is, you know, I am more advanced. I don't want this. And then you want this, so you are degraded. So what happens is the spiritual standard is made into a weapon in a domestic ego battle. And you know, I see, you want this, I don't want this, so I am advanced, you are degraded. And therefore, I am greater than you. So spiritual standards are made into a weapon in domestic ego battles. Then marriage becomes a nightmare. Because the husband and wife get into adversarial relationship over there. Adversaries means enemies. You know, as you know, if one partner wants, one partner is agitated, they want it. Another says, no, you are so attached. And then, you know, then they are meant to be partners. It's not that every whim has to be pandered to. But it is that both of them have to deal with that issue as partners. It's not that one has to catch and degrade the other person. So, they have to both arrive at in the marriage, their husband and wife have to arrive at a mutual understanding and move onwards in bhakti. So, if one person is more advanced and the other person less advanced, then it is, so in it is generally, in marriage counseling, it is advised that, you know, one's individual purity should not be stressed above the familial harmony. The family has to be harmonious. And one should not say, I want to stay pure, and that's why I won't do what you want me to do. No, both of them need to advance in purity, and both of them have to move at a pace that is compatible. So, of course, this is a discussion more for family people and marriage counselors. We don't have to get into this, but sometimes we also may have to counsel families, and sometimes we may do it in a very fanatical way. And then that can become a problem for not only us when we look at others, but others also, they can't approach us because they think we are very judgmental or we are very fanatical. So basically, the point is that in for brahmacharis, sex is something to be avoided. But for grahastha, sex is something to be regulated. It is simply a biological function. And how it is to be treated as a biological function, that they will have to arrive at their individual understanding. Individual mutual understanding. So the husband and wife have to cooperate. And it is not that one person has to prove one superiority over the other by not doing that activity and trying to show the other person as lower. No, they have to work at it in a mutually harmonious way. And yes, the wife, as you said, the wife should dress attractively. But it is not that the husband can rationalize one's immorality by saying that my wife is not coping. They have to do some kind of counseling or mutual understanding by which they maintain the family harmony. Does that address the question? Thank you very much. Rantra Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Prabhupada ki, Gaura Bhakta Vrinda ki, Vai Gaura Premanande.
You said one last reveal of question, but if you have 5-10 minutes, can we discuss it?
Because I written it down actually.
Can you come to, we can discuss sometime.
Yeah.
You can work it out.
When?
Wait a minute. Day after tomorrow, the Ekadashi.
Because I have two questions. May it be technically.
This becomes a little. All of you are
hectic.
Not hectic, this is a long time. You can talk for a few minutes. You used to, all of you take rest here only or no?
No,
normally Ramjais take rest here.
15 minutes is again. 8:45
till 9 o'clock. I was just hearing one seminar and I got few doubts, so I wrote it down. For a long time I had these doubts. So I thought I would ask because yesterday the concept of mind came. So there was, I think, Subhotra Maharaj,
conducted one seminar in Mayapur, and they were discussing few things. I heard 3-4 lectures, and I have some clarity and some doubts also. So they discuss one concept. It says that this particular concept disproves Darwin's theory. Like it disproves that how consciousness might have come out of matter. So this concept they said is that without conscious observer, they're saying that actually there is only shapeless, formless material energy without conscious, just something like Mahat. Only the conscious observer, like soul populating the universe, they give shape, let's say, to the material origin, whatever it experiences. And that way they are saying that that means that
the concept, who was this?
I think Swatra was, and one more Prabhuji is there, and few more were partnered. And then they said that that means that earth, molten earth without souls is not possible on Victor side, because it's like there is no point in shaping the material world without a soul observing it or experiencing it. And therefore this disproves Darwin theory. But then it raises more questions also then. So it would mean, at least this is what I understood from the seminar. And they're voting in between Barfield. So I don't know what is Barfield, so that is another question. And like his quotes from the quotes from Barfield. And my question is, so is this actually the way it is, like, you know?
Okay.
Like, without soul observing, like they mentioned,
okay,
one point.
Okay, I got the point. So is it that matter acquires form, or only when there's a soul observing or present without consciousness, is it that matter is just shapeless, unmanifested matter in the form of Pradhan?
Looks like little Advait in...
Yeah, is it true? See, this is basically the idea that matter does not exist with consciousness is one idea that is talked within quantum physics. Quantum physics has the idea that everything is just waves, and when there is a conscious observer, the waves collapse into tangible objects. So there are different devotees who try to sort of find some sort of relationship between science and scripture. And for that, different ways things may be proposed.
Different
ways things may be proposed. Now, none of these are definitive, because ultimately scripture has not talked about science as we modern science has analyzed the world. Scripture analyzes the world in a different way. So that's one frame, this is a different frame. And how that frame will relate with this frame, that is something which we cannot have any authoritative judgment about it. Because unless our authority is Guru Sadhu Shastra.
Yes.
So if Guru Sadhu Shastra had not explicitly said something about how that interfaces with this, to make a definitive statement, we'll have to have a lot of sound reasoning for this. So, from our perspective, matter and spirit are both energies of Krishna. That is very clear. 7th chapter talks about it, 3rd canto also talks about it. And now, does matter have a form independent of the presence of souls? That is, usually when the souls are withdrawn into the material, at the end of the Brahma's day or Brahma's life, at that time even the material form also gets withdrawn.
Yeah.
That is talked about. So in that sense, we could say that the purpose of the material existence is to facilitate the soul's engagement over here. So if the souls are not there, the purpose of the of having forms and having everything manifest in the material world, there is no purpose over there. That could be a valid reasoning. But to just say that form itself or matter will not have any form if there is no soul, there is correlation and there is causation. Correlation means that there are two factors which occur together. So for example, somebody says that cleaner cars stay durable, stay workable longer. So now there is the workability of cars and cleanliness of cars. Now these two are correlated, but are they causing? Is it that the cleanliness of the car is causing the workability of the car to be longer? Or is it that people who keep cars clean also maintain their cars well? And other things also, they do regular oiling, regular managing of the cars, and that's why the cars last longer. There's a correlation and causation.
Coincidental
correlation means the two things go together, but one is not caused by the other.
Okay.
There is some other factor involved which is causing both of them.
Okay.
So there is correlation is not causation. So just because cleaner cars are last longer doesn't necessarily mean that cleanliness causes the car to last longer.
Okay.
So it is, we could say it's true that as per the Vedic analysis of matter and spirit, matter manifests form when there are souls who want to enjoy this world or at least live in this world. And when the souls are not there, matter also becomes manifest. That is true. But that is a correlation. To say that matter itself does not have form when souls are not there, that would seem to imply a causation that it is the conscious soul which causes the soul to manifest forms, which I would say is doubtful. Because ultimately, the soul doesn't have the form, power to manifest form of matter. Both are arranged by the Supreme Lord. So we could say there is a correlation. In an absolute sense, if the souls were not there, matter would also not have form. But it is not causal. The connection is not causal, and it is quite different from what quantum physics talks about. Quantum physics talks about matter as with form doesn't exist itself. That is very, so the Vedic concept is very different. Once the material nature is manifested, suppose if the universe is annihilated, now Earth is annihilated by some atom bomb or something annihilates, hypothetically, annihilates all life. It is not that Earth's form itself will get collapsed. It is not intrinsically causal like that. There's a correlation, but not causal. And I would say that trying to refute Darwin's theory why this is a little... It is going to be convincing only for the convinced. You know, see, when I have to try to persuade someone else, I have to consider the reasoning that is intelligible and acceptable to that person. If I use reasoning that person doesn't accept only. And if a person does not believe in Shastra, and if I want to tell him God exists, and I say God exists, why? Because Bhagavad Gita says so. And that is not a reason that is going to be acceptable for them. So we have to find out what forms of reasoning are intelligible to which people, and present our scriptural principles or scripture conclusions in that form of reasoning. Then it will be intelligible for them. Is it clear?
Okay, got it. Okay. Very clear. Okay. Correlation and
causation, yeah.
Both should not be confused. We can maximum say that they are correlated.
Yeah.
From Guru Sadhu Shastra point of view. But if we want some kind of interfaith between science and this thing,
it's
then
complex.
We,
very complex.
Then
yeah.
It's not definite, but kind of speculated that.
Yeah, I would say. Okay. And unless, you know, we have to hear if that person who was there, and if you could have asked him, he could have elaborated. He was a brilliant person. And I'm sure he had his reasoning behind this.
Mm-hmm.
But at first glance, from what I can make out, it will be a little difficult to
because they are further they are saying that there is saying that this laptop, reality of this laptop, and let's say reality of rainbow, whether they are at different levels of reality, because this is closer, achievable, and more tangible, and rainbow is just visible, let's say. And they came to conclusion that yes, they are at same level. This is not given by Sotra Maharaj, I think, but another Prabhu, he gave one seminar with him only. And he said that actually both are mental signals. That means he's not denying that physical form doesn't exist, but he said that reality of that form, actually reality of object is in our mind. He says. That how that particular thing has particular signals in my mind, the way it is perceived, and then therefore this is as real as rainbow is as real as laptop or desk which is in front of me. And after that they are trying to prove, I don't know how they, therefore heaven and hell are also not very unacceptable concepts. Because I don't know how they reached that conclusion. I was not attentive in between.
So unless this sort of, see, whenever we hear things, okay, I can make this general answer. So,
but at least the first part, second part, fine. Let's forget the second part. But can we say that?
Okay, I'll explain this.
Looks like kind of a personal thing.
So when we, is it that the rainbow and laptop are both just signals in the mind, and that's why both of them are equally unreal?
Equally real.
Or equally real, whatever we want to say it. Actually, Baldev Vidya Bhushan in Govinda Bhasha analyzes this quite a bit. Especially there's a section on Vedanta Sutra which talks about Swapna. And he says that even dreams are real. Baldev Vidya Bhushan says, why? Because he says even in dreams, we are sometimes observers, sometimes participants. But we are not the ultimate controllers. So he says, who is he controlling? So it is the Supreme Lord is controlling. So even what happens in dreams, he says, the Supreme Lord says he has created this world, gross world, to give us the reactions to our gross karma. So similarly, to minor karmas, reactions he gives through the dreams. So for example, some people get bad dreams a lot. That's a reaction to karma, minor reaction. Some people may suffer a lot in real life, some people suffer in dreams. So in that perspective, he says, and another reasoning he gives is, even a dream, sometimes the Lord appears. So that also indicates that dreams are real. So from our perspective, if we are considering real in terms of something which exists eternally, matter is unreal. But if you are considering real in terms of whether it exists at present, yes, this definitely exists at present. So it is real. So matter is real in that sense. Even dreams are considered real by Acharyas, because we understand that the subtle level of reality is also real. Can sit comfortably. Okay. That is also a real level of reality. And now, when we talk about rainbow, so laptop, from the point of view of gross matter, it really exists. There may be signals in the brain associated with that laptop. But, and in terms of simply neurochemical signals, if we say, if I am working on a laptop or I am thinking of working on a laptop, there may not be substantial difference in neurochemical signals. Since that similar signals might be secreted. So if the brain were the only reality I could observe, then I would not be able to see, I would not be able to differentiate whether the object that is being, which is being reported, whose signals are being reported in the mind, that object really exists or not. But the brain is connected to the senses, and we can touch and feel and work on things. So the objects are tangible also. So in that sense, they have a level of reality, which is grosser or which is more physical than the level of reality which is of a rainbow. So rainbow, if we think of something in terms of what is perceived in the sky with our eyes, it's not a physical gross object which we can touch with our senses. If you go there, there's no rain. We are perceiving with our eyes. Now, in that sense, it may not be of the same level of reality. If you consider reality in terms of subtle reality or gross reality, that is a continuum. Even that gross reality is something which is perceived by all the senses, something which is perceived by some sense and not by other senses. So, it's all, I would say, real, and there are different levels of reality to it. So, we can't just arbitrarily infer anything about the ontological status of something based on brain signals. Brain signals can report to us something entirely imaginary, brain signals can report to us something entirely real, and both may produce some similar signals. So we can't infer anything about the nature of reality based on brain signals. So all that we can say is that from our philosophical perspective, there are levels of reality. And different things can exist at different levels of reality. So, beyond that, to say anything further is, in general, as a matter of principle, I would say that whenever devotees analyze matter and try to explain matter based on Shastra or based on common sense and try to correlate with science, no, I would say none of that has to be taken as authoritative. Because that is ultimately inference drawn from Shastra, and how much of it is one's own individual understanding, how much of it is not individual understanding, we have to see. And if we find it convincing, if we find it inspiring, well and good. But we don't have to get caught in it. If that is what is our interest and that's what we want to go deep into, that's okay. But if it's just something which we have heard and we find it interesting, I would not. The Bhagavatam's primary purpose is to tell us how to attain Krishna. And some devotees may use Bhagavatam to try to analyze the material world and understand it. But these are, that's a different way of doing it. And that is not the central point of Shastra. So, if somebody is making claims that seem counterintuitive, that seem very difficult to understand or difficult to explain, then better, unless we understand it, unless we can explain it, better not to quote it, better not to go into it. We don't have to make judgment about whether what that devotee is saying is right or wrong, because they may have particular background, particular understandings which we may not have. But in general, unless it's a specific area of interest or service, there's no need to get into too much analysis of matter. Some devotees may find it that, you know, the traditional way of living, it is very compatible for practicing bhakti and preaching bhakti. And they may explore the traditional mode of living. And they may use it for preaching. Very well. Some other devotees may explore modern technology a lot. And through technology, understanding how technology works, they may use that for preaching. If somebody wants to preach on the internet, they understand SEO optimization and all that. That is one way of preaching. You know, understanding the traditional, how villages, how the farm communities was there, how things were in the tradition. It's also another thing. So it's not that the only those who are doing the traditional are right, or only those who are doing the technological are right, or not that one is right and other is wrong. It's that these are different ways of engaging with this world for fulfilling our purpose of serving Krishna and sharing His message. So if something is relevant for us, if something is intelligible for us, if something is inspiring for us, we can get into it. But if we are not able to understand, if we are not able to analyze it too much, then better not get into it at all.
Okay? Actually, Guruji, you answered my third question. Third question was same that. Should we, how much this kind of analysis is conducive for bhakti? So that was my third question.
I think you have to be careful about it. Don't get into it. If it is interesting.